Hi, this is Rick Emerson, and the following encore of The Rick Emerson Show is brought to you by Squires Electric. Whether it's electrical wiring, Ethernet wiring, or wiring of any kind at all in your home or business, Squires Electric can make your life easier. Find out more at squireselectric.com or call 503-252-1609. Squires Electric.
If you're ever in some logging town and you meet one on the street, you're going to think there's the meanest man anybody'd want to meet. But when you really get to know one, that's when you'll understand.
Well, there walks a logger. There walks a man.
I've seen two loggers stand toe-to-toe and slug it out in a free-for-all fight. And when it was over, they'd get up and shake hands and laugh and drink together the rest of that night. I've seen a logger pick up a baby bird and put it back into its nest. And I've never heard one criticizing a man when he knew he was doing his best. They're a rough, rowdy breed of people, but it's a rough life they live. And most of the time their job's demanding just a little bit more than they can give. They come home at night so doggone tired, bruised and cut and sore. Get up next morning with a big old grin and go right back out for more. To the same steep muddy hillsides they were cussing the day before.
Well, there walks a logger. There walks a man.
I think logger loves his family just a little bit more than most men, because he knows if he makes just one mistake, he'll never get to see him again. Oh, a line could break or a tail hold slip and cut a man half in two. The danger's there lurking everywhere and the rewards are just all too few. But it's a life he chose, and whichever way it goes, his family will understand. Because when he walks in through that door at night, they know that there walks a man. Loggers don't sit around much discussing church, religion, or prayer. But a wise man once said, if you ever get to heaven, you'll be surprised who you run into there. And when the last trumpet's been sounded, all of life's secrets unfold. We'll find more than one set of cork boot tracks on those streets that are solid gold.
Where there walks a logger, there walks a man.
It is 28 minutes after the hour of one of this, the month of May, the year of our Lord, 2011. Thank you for coming by, making a part of your listening day. We are live from the lushly appointed yet not overly ostentatious studios of the Emerson News Network, looming high above the milkpacking district here in the heart of glorious southeast Portland, Oregon, the home of all good peoples. We got to thank our... we're thanking everything the good that has come to this program in the last, like, 5 days has been from Siegfried. News of the fire, Siegfried. And Cheryl. Photo of the zombie economics display by the Christian inspirational books, Siegfried. There walks a logger, there walks a man by Buzz Martin, Siegfried. By the way, the flip side of that, the logger's reward, which I haven't heard, but which I'm trying to find it. I'm seeking it out. So,
well, you know, maybe you should just do this show with Siegfried then.
I was thinking
if you love him so much.
I was really feeling that
you married him.
The obvious answer was to start doing the show with a logger, Don.
Oh, well, that too.
So,
because loggers, very manly.
I mean, there's, you know, there's no rule we couldn't do both. I mean, it could be Rick and Don and the logger. That didn't really work. It could be
Rick and Don and the logger.
It could be there was a radio station in San Diego when I lived there, and it was Dave Shelley and Chainsaw as the morning show. And you would see this huge billboard, and it was like, and that was like right after I got blown out in Utah. I got fired in Utah, and so I was like, well, F this city. So I did this. So Laura and I packed up all our stuff. We were going to move to Los Angeles, but then we realized, wait a minute, Los Angeles sucks. Let's move to San Diego. In San Diego, sort of great too, because in San Diego, you feel like you're Lot, you know, except with the whole business of being able to turn around and look back at Sodom and Gomorrah without turning into a pillar of salt, you know? Because from San Diego, you can kind of see or at least sense Los Angeles. It's there if you need it for something. But, you know, you don't ever have to, you don't have to actually be in it or be near it or be close enough that can touch your skin or your soul and burn them. So we lived in Los Angeles, and I was, you know, I was between assignments, as they say, trying to get a radio gig. And I was there for like, I don't know, 8 months or something before I moved here. But, you know, I think before the internet was really a mechanism by which you could be sending in, you know, like you could send an air check or something, you know, to a radio station. Like there wasn't, you know, if you're going to send like a 20-minute air check, I mean, there was just no way. The capacity to, the ability to do that was restricted by the fact that I think we still had like a 14-4 modem or something. So I was not really able to, which meant I was obliged to just go down to like the FedEx place or whatever, you know, like 2, 3, 4, 5 times a week, spending money I did not have to apply for jobs I would not get. In an industry that was clearly not willing to accept the unique talents I had to offer. And I had to go to the FedEx place down, I forget what it was. It was like down on the, like Alabama Street or something where we lived. We lived in this neighborhood called Hillcrest. And as I would have to drive to the FedEx office like 2, 3 times a week to mail all this stuff up to radio stations, where I just knew it was just going in a mulching pile. I mean, that's the thing. It's like I guess it's like at movie studios, they have like a slush pile where it's like scripts come in and scripts just go on the pile, and then the scripts go home to line the cage of the birds that belong to the director's daughters. And I don't know what they do with stuff at other industries, but in radio stations, things just go into the bulking pile. And the bulking pile, back when we used to send in cassette tapes with our air checks on them, the bulking pile was just a place where you would take all of the cassette tapes that people had sent their air check, their hopes and dreams ensconced on magnetic oxide tape. And you'd just stick them in there because eventually you'd need blank tapes to send commercials out on. And so you would just go to the pile of dreams and you'd say, hold on a second, I need like a 10-minute tape. Oh, there's one. Who's this? Somebody looking for a job? No. And you would just run it over the electronic erasing machine, the degausser. And immediately just someone's hopes and aspirations just electronically just sucked out, magically destroyed. So I would be sending off all of this crap to radio stations trying to get a job.
Like that's sort of bad karma, isn't it? That you're sending out your hopes and dreams on the destroyed hopes and dreams of others?
Well, that wasn't me. I'm saying this is like at a radio station. Mm-hmm. If you ever needed to put something on TV, this is back when they...
you weren't like swiping them and then sending them out yourself for other jobs.
No. That was... I'm just saying if you work at a radio... Mm-hmm. This is when I was unemployed. If you work at a radio station, though, and somebody's like, hey, I got to send a client wants a copy of a commercial, or like, we got to send out like a demo of the station to some, like, an ad agency or something. Before there was MP3, you would just have to put all that stuff on a cassette. And cassettes, you know, you're going to buy those? I don't think so. You just swing by the program director's office and you go, hey, have any poor fools applied for jobs this week? And he'd say, yes, a whole drawer full of them. Look. And say, give me 3 of those. And he'd go, okay. And he wouldn't even, he'd just reach in randomly like he was playing bingo balls. And he would just hand you...
The equivalent of the slush pile in publishing.
But it's like if you were just... But imagine if you were taking the slush pile, and as they came in, you were just turning them over and putting them in the copy machine because you needed something to photograph your butt onto.
Yeah.
That's really what it was. And so anyway, I had to go to the FedEx place to send my air check off to radio stations who were clearly not going to hire me. And every day I had to drive by this huge billboard for whatever this radio station was, and it just said in gigantic letters... Dave Shelley and the Chainsaw Mornings. And it was like that. You would just see that on the way there, where I would then check my P.O. box. Oh, I guess it's just another day of empty solitude. Close it, and then I have to drive back home by the billboard of Dave Shelley and the Chainsaw. And like the 100th time I did that, really when you start to just ask yourself, like, is this life for me? I don't mean the life of radio. I mean, really, this life, this go-around in the karmic circle. Should I just give it another spin and see if I come back as, you know, perhaps a hedgehog or a weevil or something? In any event, so I don't know what we'd call the logger. We'd have to, one of us would have to change our name and it would have to start with an L. You know, it'd have to be like, you know, Larry, Liz, and the Logger. Or the Logger and the Blogger.
There we go.
And then I would be, and a guy named Rick. Logger and Blogger and a guy named Rick. Mornings.
Logger, the Blogger, and Rick. That actually has a nice kind of a thing to it.
That's exactly why they do it, Don, because people like you hear it and go, that is a pleasant linguistic flow to it. I think I'll listen to that station and see if it picks me up and makes me feel good throughout the workday.
I wouldn't listen to it, but I think that, you know, it has a nice rhythm to it.
It has a nice flow to it. That's what I'm saying. And then
it's like I've never listened to Porkchop. I'm sure he's a lovely person, and when he was on the radio, and I would say, oh, look, there's a guy named Porkchop. That's an amusing DJ name, but it never made me want to listen to
him.
What an
amusing thing that I'll never sample.
Yeah.
Well done, radio station.
Opie and Anthony. It has kind of a nice sound to it. Never heard them. Never heard anything they've done, ever.
Not once. Not even accidentally.
Never, ever, no.
Excellent. It's hard to believe the radio isn't thriving. You were listening to the Rick Emerson radio program. It is 503-505-6964 if you would like to be part of today's program, and I know you would. That is 503-505-6964. You can also email if you like. It's rick@rickemerson.com. That is rick@rickemerson.com or Don Taylor. She can be emailed at don@rickemerson.com. You can also hit us up in the text box or at the Skype. That is Rick Emerson Show. That is all one word via Skype. That is Rick Emerson Show. Hey, speaking of things, and speaking of Don and the Logger and the Blogger, I don't know what this means. I got one of those. It wasn't a direct message. It was like a tweet that mentioned me, and so I guess I got like CC'd on it or whatever. And it's from yesterday. Well, it's from 8 hours ago, so that would have been like 6 a.m. or something. And it's a quote from you, and it says it's from 8 hours ago. So again, around 6 a.m. And it says, "Quote: Can we end the show so I can go home?" Close quote. And it says, @DonTaylor on the Rick Emerson Show.
Yeah, I think I did say that one day. We were having one of those long, weary shows, and it was just going on and on. And I do believe there was one point.
Do you know why that would have been posted this morning?
Probably somebody listening to a show back in the archives.
Is somebody who's just now catching up? Do you think is somebody who's they're lagging behind the rest of the children?
Yeah, I don't remember what day it was I said that, but I do recall that at some point I did say that at the end of the show.
Excellent. All right, and I can check that off the list of things I was worried about. All right, fantastic. Coming up today, we got your Penis Watch, Clown Watch, Nazi Watch. Also, we'll recap last night's episode of Justified. Last night's season finale, Justified, episode 13, season 2. So we will talk about that. And
no, last night's episode.
You really
of
did
Justified.
Become. You did really did become the Blogger of Logger and Blogger and Rick just there. Holy moly!
Oh my God! Okay, I just want to say this one thing about Justified. I don't want to get off on Justified yet because we're going to have a whole section on it. But there was a point at which I actually towards the end there was a big shootout. And there was a point when I actually paused and rewound and then went frame for frame so I could see that I actually saw this. There was a very quick little moment. I don't know if you caught it during the shootout. When they like digitally added blood spatter to what was ostensibly supposed to look at, like at the camera.
You mean it like a POV sort of a thing?
Yeah. It was, and I went back and I was like, did I just see what I thought I said? I went back and I went click, 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 and look at it. And it went by so quick. So it was obviously just a little artistic thing, I think, to make the scene even more like gory
like
for the viewer.
Blood spray on the camera, but obviously CGI'd.
Yeah, but so quick that I think they were trying that it would almost be, you know, what's the word?
You're going to say subliminal, which isn't what you mean, but I know what you mean.
I was going to say it was. Because it was fast enough you could see it, so it obviously wasn't subliminal. But it was so quick, I think it was meant to just sort of just be a really quick little throwaway for
that you register subconsciously.
Right, exactly. And so it was really, really odd.
It's an interesting. Here's the thing that weirds me out is that we've now reached the point where sometimes they will use CGI to actually put in things that theoretically you would not want there. And this is a thing they started to do even before Photoshop, just with retouching of photographs, because traditionally photographers don't want flares in the shot. And if you don't know, what a flare is, you've seen this a million times. It's like when you see a shot when there's sometimes it's like at a concert, but usually when there's the sun out or something, and it's just a little halo. It's a round circle of light that is almost like a doubled image of the sun. And that is a thing that photographers...
See the most recent Star Trek reboot in which they did that in probably about every fifth shot.
Or like every Garth Brooks album cover that you've ever seen in your life. Or every one of those posters, it'll be a movie poster that it has just like the big floating heads of the main characters, especially if it is if it's set anywhere in the future or in space, or if there's any sort of a desert sequence, because you'll see the sun over the horizon, and then you'll see the sort of dappling of progressively smaller circles of light coming down, you know, sort of out at you toward, you know, toward you, the viewer. And photographers spent like 70 years trying to figure out how not to get flares in the shot. And then as soon as they figured out how to retouch an airbrush, a guy, let's put more flares in the shot.
I think it's with the movies and TV, I think in some cases, well, with Star Trek, J.J. Abrams obviously was using it as, and his, whoever his cinematographer
an homage.
Was. It was an obvious stylistic choice on the part of the DP. I mean, because it was happening all the time. It was very much the look of the movie. They were going to have these bright flares like everywhere. But a lot of times, like with the blood splatter digitally added and stuff like that, a lot of times I think it's to make stuff look more deliberately low tech. So it adds, I think they believe it adds a sense of realism. Like on some psychological level, it makes you feel more like it's actually happening because they didn't make it, they didn't get this thing out of there, you know, except that they're actually adding the thing in. So it looks more, I guess, real.
I think the best example that I've seen of that, and it, because it just makes your mind hurt after a while, the best example is in Harry Potter and I believe it's Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire. Yes? No? I think. It's either in Goblet of Fire or it's in Order of the Phoenix. But there's a sequence where they show Hogwarts and it's during the wintertime. And it's so, you know, it's all the grounds outside are all snow covered and whatever. And anybody who is familiar with Hogwarts, as you all ought to be, there is the Whomping Willow. And the Whomping Willow is this tree, so called because if you get near it, it'll grab you and then just beat you against the ground like a rug on cleaning day. And the willow, of course, is covered with snow as well because it's wintertime. And there's this great moment where, like, I don't know, like Hagrid or somebody is walking by the Whomping Willow and gets close enough that the tree doesn't grab him, but the tree sort of lunges at him a little bit. And then he walks out of the frame. And then the tree, again, which is just a goddamn tree. It's like rooted to the ground. It can just move. The tree does a thing like your dog does after it's been in the river. The tree kind of went and shook off. And a little lump of snow hit the lens and then went and just left a little watermark behind, which is then that's where your brain just does somersaults on itself because you're going, well, that's a thing. Well, none of that exists.
Yeah, the tree doesn't actually exist.
There's
so that
nothing
could not
there.
Have happened.
Yeah, there's nothing in the sequence is real. And it's like, it really was. And they did it. It was real quick, as I think.
I think it's the same thing like with this blood spray. It happens really quick. And their hope is the effect will make it, on some level in your brain, it will make it feel more real for you.
Right. It's that you are, because I think people have such a negative reaction to the idea of, or certainly to the hearing that something is CG. You know, how many times have you there's just way too much CGI in that, because people have this idea that it's much more impressive to see an actual thing. And so I think now that's become a little bit of a game to see how far you can blur the lines. Here's a great idea. By the way, it is Thursday, so there'll be no rhyme or reason to anything we do today, and that's just going to have to be fine with everybody.
It's Thursday. We've got to come up with a Thursday song. We need a Thursday song.
Dawn Taylor is the blogger. Here's what you should do: is you should you and the rest of the production staff should get some sales guys and go sing a Thursday jingle and have it ready for tomorrow. Maybe do it to the tune of a contemporary pop song,
yeah, okay.
And then I'll chortle. Maybe not.
I'll get our marketing people on that.
But before we do anything else, I was just going to say, wait, now the hell, what was I going to say? About CG. Here's the thing that I'm surprised somebody hasn't done. This is a marketing thing that is just sitting there, just on the table, just screaming to be picked up and used. I am surprised that somebody has not done the marketing shtick of everybody in this, you know, all that everybody in this film is doing their own stunts. That every single stunt is done by the actual participants, by the actual actors. Or that every single stunt, even if the actual actors don't want to do it, even if you're not going to get Kevin Spacey to do a stunt, you say every stunt done by real somebody. You know, because that was the big selling point of Jackie Chan when they ported him over to the States. He's the stuntman who does all his own stunts. And that was a thing that, you know, if for people who had never heard of Jackie Chan before, and I'd had some limited exposure to him because I had been friends with guys who were freaks for Jackie Chan movies, and I knew a little bit about him, but really, if you'd asked me to describe him, I would have said, oh, yeah, he's that actor that does all of his own stunts. I'm surprised that they haven't started branding movies. Like, Tarantino should do that. Like he was doing with the kind of Rolling Thunder, Grindhouse, B-movie stuff. Tarantino should do some sort of a secondary or tertiary brand of films where the brand's trademark is that all of the stunts are real. And then you put in like a huge at the top, you know, like where it says Star Wars, The Empire Strikes Back.
Well, not even that. I mean, if the demands of the film are such, if it's not like a science fiction movie or something like that, actually market the fact that you have nothing but like practical effects
CG,
as well. Yeah.
You could actually do that as like a huge, what are those? Now, I don't know what anything's called. But, you know, like one of those big Starburst things you stick at the top where it says 10% off. But it would be like no CGI. Because, you know, Queen used to do that on their records when you pick up a Queen record. And they quit doing this, I think, around like the time of like innuendo. But when you pick up a Queen record, it actually said on the inside, it would be like Brian May play guitar, Freddie Mercury sang, da-da-da-da. And then at the bottom it would say no one played a synthesizer. Rage Against the Machine did the same thing because Rage Against the Machine, people always thought that there was turntable work happening or that people thought that there was scratching or that there was sort of, and they would actually say in huge letters, all sounds on this record were made by drums, bass, guitar, and vocals, which is a sort of great, I mean, it's not like I have any problem with CG, not have any problem with synthesizers or anything, but it is sort of a great, it's a great statement of intention. It's a great sort of manifesto, which I'm a big fan of in terms of marketing. And also, it does make you listen to things a little bit differently, especially because so much of this stuff is just used so badly. I mean, just so terribly how many times you go, I mean, that Fast Five I know is out now, which is apparently great, and they're calling it the best of the series and whatever, but you just know it's going to be, as I always say, it's going to be a lot of like cars falling off of trucks on the highway and then flying at the camera, which will not impress me because I know it's not real.
I'm impressed by two different ends of the spectrum. I'm impressed when something is so great that it makes me go, wow, that is like I notice that it's camera work, that there's magic going on, and that it just sort of amazes me. Children of whatever
the Corn.
No,
a Lesser God.
The movie with
Children of Men.
Children of Men. There's a car sequence where the car is driving and the camera is going much like there's a similar sequence in Spielberg's War of the Worlds where the camera is outside the car,
right,
and is moving around the car while they're driving, and then following conversations that they're having, but it's like going through the window and in the window and around the outside of the car, all the while managing to like maintain this illusion that they're driving.
Right.
And it's just mind-bogglingly well done. Just staggeringly well done. And there's this thing, and even while you're watching it, you're just going, oh my God, this is awesome.
Yeah.
This is just awesome filmmaking. And the other thing I like is when it's obviously a very, very practical effect. And I think that that's one of the ways in which people, as much credit, as much plaudits as Inception got last year, there wasn't, I think, enough credit given for some of the effects that were obviously practical effects.
Right.
There's an entire ongoing sequence in the last third of the movie with Joseph Gordon-Levitt basically coming unstuck in gravity, essentially. And he's like trying to make his way down a hotel room corridor, anything, when gravity does not exist in this dream world he's in. And it's very obviously primarily, it's wire work. I mean, he's in a harness and he's like physically doing this. This is not all CGI. And I think that it was just stunning to watch because it was beautifully shot and choreographed. And he, of course, is awesome in everything he does. But that, again, there's a lot of really great CGI work in Inception. But that whole worked mostly because of Levitt being able to act in a harness upside down. And that he'd actually had a choreographer work with him to do this just amazing, amazing thing.
It must be one of those things where they just, where at a certain point they just don't do it because they figure just nobody cares. They just go, nah, nobody cares. They're idiots. Just CG it. I mean, that's got to be the thing, right? Don't they just figure that at a certain point that audiences are just morons?
Yeah. And also it's a lot cheaper at this point. In most cases, it's just a lot less expensive to have guys do stuff in a computer than to build sets and to set stuff up and to pay stuntmen and what have you.
And I have I have zero problem with CG. To me, the whole thing is like, it's all about what you do with it. I mean, I have no, it's like I know a lot of, I was trying to play a, this is the comparison that I always make about CG. It's like I was trying to play a record for somebody, I don't know, about a year and a half ago, and it was this, I don't remember what it was, but it was some band. And it was kind of an electronic sort of a record, and there was, you know, a lot of synth work and whatever, but it was, you know, but these really great songs. And I was playing it, you know, for the person, and they just said, in a way that made me, in a way that just sort of screamed to be beaten with a brick, they just said, well, that's good, but, you know, I like, you know, real instruments. And I just wanted to go, like, okay, first of all, a keyboard is a real instrument. Jagoff. Second of all, you know, if I gave you the instrument they had, if I gave you the electronic crap in their studio and gave you 15 years, you couldn't do this. So, to me, it's all about what you do with it. And, you know, I know a lot of bands that have real instruments that suck. The Grateful Dead play real instruments. Not going to listen. So, it's... But the problem is that very few people use CG for its intended purpose, in my opinion, which is to be invisible. You know, there's a lot of... Now, there's a lot of practical effects in Lord of the Rings. There's a lot of goddamn CG in Lord of the Rings. Mm-hmm. And I mean... But most of it isn't like Gollum. Most of it is stuff that you don't notice.
Yeah.
It's like where they have... It's where they'll have like a... They'll have a bigature, they called it. Not really a miniature of a castle, but I mean, you know, certainly not life size. They'd have a castle that was like the size of a smallish room or whatever, that was maybe a few feet high and 10 feet across. But then they would have to create this entire landscape behind it. And they would, and all of that would be CG, but it would be seamless. You would never be able to spot it. And because they paint in the corner. And I think now it's just a thing to create stuff that is... Here's the worst use of CG really pound for pound, when you think about all of the talent and all of the money that went into this film and what they could have done with it. The single worst use of CG that I have ever seen in a movie, I think, has nothing to do with the fact that you're going, well, that doesn't really exist. Because really, most things you see in films don't really exist at all, ever, in the real world. I mean, there really aren't giant apes climbing to the top of things. It doesn't happen all that often. The worst use of CG I have ever seen is the opening sequence to Attack of the Clones. And it's not like Attack of the Clones is a great movie anyway, but you're thinking, okay, well, Spielberg's a hack, given that I understand that. We all accept
Lucas.
Lucas. Lucas is clearly, I mean, he's, you know, that is a guy who just churns it out now as a way to sort of, you know, support his alimony payments. I get that that's the case. But it's not like everybody around him is a boob. It's not like he's just surrounded by talentless morons. Yet, if you look at that opening for Attack of the Clones, clearly they just put 5,000 battleships or whatever in space, and then they just hit Control-C, Control-V for like an hour and just pasted it everywhere. And there's no thought or imagination given to it whatsoever. That's the misuse of CG, is where they can fill a whole starfield full of crap you don't care about.
The only times that I really find myself disliking CG are in, particularly in car chases, in action sequences, and especially stuff that involves vehicles and chases, because the idea that they can do the stuff in the computer and therefore save themselves the money and the danger of having actual stuntmen do stuff. The thing is, then they also have a tendency to go just slightly overboard and say, because now we can do anything. We can have cars flip upside down 14-7 and then just burst into flame. And then now something's flying through the air and going through the windshield. But the thing is, even in just a chase sequence, like if you look at a racing, like in Tokyo Drift, there's this part of you that is aware of the fact that those are not cars.
Yeah.
And they're not actually doing anything. And so there's no real inherent sense of thrill or suspense. On the other hand, you look at something like Tarantino's Death Proof, and you're watching Zoe Bell, who is a professional stuntwoman, actually clinging to
the
top
of a car
that is actually driving. And there's this part of you that your stomach just starts tying up in knots, because
it's a visceral thrill.
It is. You know you are watching someone doing something dangerous.
Yeah, I have a lot of problems with Death Proof, but it really was worth the whole thing existing just for that sequence, as just sort of a look at this, wham, you know, because here's a thing nobody does anymore. Here's last great idea, and then we got at least hint at some of the stuff we're gonna.
Okay.
We have to hint at the things we're gonna promise to do that we will clearly not do later on.
All right.
Final great marketing idea. This is on the heels of the somebody got to market a film is like blah blah blah, all their own stunts, no CGI. Also prostitute. What's another great entertainment idea? Nobody's ever done my Vietnam musical, my Apocalypse Wow. You can have that. Just be fun-loving gay troops in Saigon.
Your Anne Frank and the Hitler Frankenstein.
And the Diary of Anne Frank and Stein.
Yes.
Lloyd Kaufman's coming back to town, though, and I'm going to pitch that to him. I swear to God, I'm going to get myself in a room with Lloyd Kaufman. I'm going to get in a room with Lloyd Kaufman for like 15 seconds, And I'm going to pitch it to him, and I guarantee you he'll I'll tell you what. If Troma doesn't find that to be a great idea, then it's like, I give up. I have to see that I don't know anything about movies or Troma or how anything in this world works if they don't like that idea. Following up on Avatar, which of course is such a huge international bar setter in terms of not just box office returns but also the 3D and the use of CG and all that stuff. You know what Cameron ought to do? Because you know what Cameron's overriding motivator is not money. Cameron's overriding motivator is not. I don't think it's box office success as such. I think Cameron is motivated by two things. I think, A, he really honestly does want to make great films. Now, he doesn't always succeed, but I think Cameron is always trying to top himself, and he's always trying to make a great movie. Sometimes he succeeds. He does not. Sometimes he makes Avatar. But so he's, I think, is legitimately artistic and wants to create things that are thrilling to him and things that he would like to see as a viewer. But he's also motivated just by, like, showing everybody that his balls are more massive than all the other balls on Earth put together. That the sack carried by Cameron is larger and more substantial than the sack carried by anybody else. I mean, he is obviously a macho guy and has a real strongly defined sense of machismo and I think of dominance over his art form and his craft. That is what informs so much of his film's sensibilities. That there is this like incredible aggressive alpha male energy to everything Cameron does. So, given that the fact that everything Cameron does just seems to be motivated by like whizzing on his competitors, having done Avatar, he ought to just announce that he's going to make a film for $1 million and no CG, and then go and make like the best action movie that anybody has ever seen. And he should just say he's going to do it with $1 million, no CG, and a crew of like five people. And offer to let it be documented and confirmed by any outside media source that wants to. They can follow him around and watch them make the film and confirm that there is no CGI and that they make the entire thing with that crew and that much money. You know? If he really just wanted to cement his reputation as an absolute godhead, that's all he would have to do at this point. And something like that would win him back every bit of geek cred that he may have gotten a bit of a slippery grasp on post-Avatar. So, James, you can have that idea if you're listening. That's a Rick Emerson original, but I'm giving it now to you, sir. Okay, can we go home?
Sure, why not?
No, I'm sorry.
Oh, no.
It's channeling the blogger there.
The people want a show.
Let's see. Penis Watch today, Clown Watch, Nazi Watch, last night's Justified will be recapped, and Don Taylor's tracking the following headlines for you on this Thursday.
A homeless man is arrested for moving out of his dumpster. A man passes out, and his 5-year-old daughter takes the wheel and drives him home. And Newt Gingrich is going to run for president.
Is he really?
That's what he says.
It's all
That's
happening.
What they're saying.
Excellent. It's all going according to plan. let's see. What else? I got two emails to read here.
Okay.
Do you want to hear the one that, about smells or the one that has the word douche in the subject line?
Oh, go with the douche one.
All right, we'll start with that one. This is from our friend Seamus. He said, I think they're actually both from Seamus. Well, because as we've noted, he's the only person awake when I am at like 4 in the morning. Subject line, I guess I'm douching now. Mm. That's a thing you don't anticipate hearing from a guy, you know?
No. And also, how are you emailing at the same time? Because I think that takes both hands.
Well, I think that's that Doc Ock setup that he's got. He says, I just bought a new bottle of Old Spice body wash.
Oh.
They've changed the label. It now says body wash, and below that it just says gel douche.
Yeah.
So there you go. Which seems like a thing that, I mean, I know douche means shower or wash, and that is it is French, and that's why they do that. But just from a marketing point of view, don't you think that they would realize that that's going to be a thing that X number of guys are going to go, well, I guess I'll buy the, hold on, very nearly picked up the douche. Mm-hmm. Better get something else.
Maybe it's a descriptive about the kind of person that uses Old Spice body wash.
Is it?
I'm just saying. I mean, it would be more appropriate maybe on Axe body spray, but.
So you believe that Seamus is the. He's that kind of guy.
He may have just chosen poorly, is all I'm saying.
Okay, you're not saying that he's changed as a person. You're
no.
saying that maybe the product changed underneath him, and now he must realign his product choices
exactly.
to reflect his personality.
Precisely.
Okay. Hey, did your dad use Old Spice?
No.
Okay, that surprises me, because our dads appear to have been the same person. And, you know, my dad was all about the Old Spice. Every now and again, every once in a while, L'Aqua Velva. Mm-hmm. But it was almost always Old Spice.
I think my dad didn't really care that much about it. My dad mostly wore whatever was in the the collectible Avon decanter that I gave him for Christmas that year.
Excellent.
And I remember one year my mom gave him a bottle of High Karate as a joke.
Yes, and he wore it, didn't he?
He did.
Yes, he did. Yeah, but there was the and Old Spice at one point.
I did have an uncle who wore Old Spice, though.
Does it? And see, the Old Spice to me is that's a thing. I would imagine right now. I don't really know. This is why we need some sort of a laboratory so we can just, you know, we need some idea mill. One of us needs to win Powerball, first of all. And then we're just going to set up a factory where I just think of stuff and then I send people off to either do it or a theories and I send people off to test it. For example, I think if you could get all of the women who, born and lived in the United States who are now between the ages of 35 and 60, if you could get all the women between 35 and 60 right now in the United States and put them in a room and just say, all right, ladies, I want you to smell something, and then just scent the air with Old Spice, I'd bet like 65% of them would immediately be flooded by weird, husband-daddy imagery,
daddy issues, daddy issues and funny uncle memories.
That's totally what that would be, because that is like, for the longest time, that was the definitive American male cologne. That is what men wore. And I don't know why that just took over, because he was talking about the Old Spice thing. So it seems like that's such a, and they've done such a great job of branding it with you know, the White and Kennedy commercials, that it's like, it just, as dumb as it sounds to get bent out of shape about the word douche being on it, you would just think that somebody in the marketing department would go, hold on. We got this real manly guy who's been advertising it lately. Chicks love him. Guys want to be him. You can't be putting the word douche on the product. Let's take that back a step before we release it to the public.
Think about it, though. When you think about how many women, yes, of a certain age, had fathers who wore Old Spice. The Old Spice people should actually use that as part of their advertising.
Just say,
Chicks
smells like dad.
Chicks got daddy issues.
Yes, that's exactly what they should do.
Smell like daddy, and you're in.
Oh my God.
Old Spice.
Old Spice. Smell like daddy.
Exactly. Yes.
I'm gonna tweet that. Would that look creepy if I tweet it? Will it look like I have daddy issues?
No, you want to say
attention, Old Spice.
Maybe you say ad campaign idea, or something like that.
Attention, Old Spice, new marketing idea. Smell like daddy. Okay, awesome. Well, today's already one in the win column, Don. I think we really can go home. We already did the headline thing, right? Old Spice.
Yep.
Ba 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 ba. Oh, here's a question I have for you.
All right.
I just have a bunch of stuff piling up in my head today. I'm just going to be honest. You know what today is? Today is a day I am full of cerebral odds and ends.
Well, here's the thing. I don't know what your schedule is like, but Greg and Sarah already recorded for the day. So, you know, let's just do what we want to do. We can go as long as we need to.
As opposed to the other days where we follow a strict schedule.
Well, some days we do.
Yeah,
we got things we're supposed to be doing.
Here's a question I have, though. So the thing about, you know, like uncles and dads smelled like Old Spice because that's what men wore. And plus, I think that was, unless you lived in a large metropolitan city filled with all kinds of people, many of them not like you. Men didn't really wear. Men wore cologne to a certain degree. Men didn't want to wear anything perfumey. Men didn't want to. The whole thing about men was, you know, you wanted to smell good without looking like you were, you know, being girly or anyway. You didn't want to seem fruity. And so that's why Old Spice with their navy imagery, because there's just nothing gay about that. Men would put that on because it was a way to be, to attract the ladies while still being masculine. So as a result, they had like a 95 share of the market. Now, was there an equivalent perfume for women? Is it like Chanel No. 5 or something? Like the default selection for perfume for women was whatever?
I think it depends on, a lot of it depends on economic status and sort of class. I know that when I was growing up and when I was a teenager, what is it called? I want to say Estee Lauder, and that's not it. It's this, oh my God, it's this horrible crap that reeks, and it comes in a yellow bottle.
I have some horrible crap that reeks.
Yeah, and it was, I can't remember what the name is. Is it Estee Lauder? No, Estee Lauder's a makeup company. It's something like that.
Jeanette.
Jean Nate, that's it, Jean Nate.
Really?
And, oh my God, and it was one of those things that people would give other... I don't think anyone ever chose it.
10 points if you can guess why I knew Jeanette.
Because your mom wore it.
Yes.
Yeah. And people would give it to other people as, like, you know, gift collections or that sort of thing. And, oh my God, that stuff was horrible. Oh God, that reeked.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was your basic drugstore ladies' cologne when I was growing up. I remember my grandmother wore Taboo.
Oh, wow. Really?
Yes.
Because she was a sex machine.
Oh yeah, grandma was sexy.
What Taboo do you suppose your grandmother was breaking exactly? Yeah.
My grandmother was married 5 times.
Oh, well, okay.
And she was one of those grandmothers that, like, you know, she when I was a kid, she was between husbands and she was dating a lot. And she was the grandma who had the big console stereo cabinet.
Yes, yes.
And then the giant oversized brandy snifter on it, filled with the matchbooks from all of the nightclubs and bars she had gone to.
Of course.
So that's the grandma I had. I remember she had a bottle. I think it was the Taboo bottle. It was a little collectible bottle she had got that looked like a cat, a Siamese cat, and it had little rhinestone eyes. And it was in its bathroom, and I thought that in her bathroom, and I thought that was like so cool when I was like 6.
All right. At some point, if you have a photo of your grandmother's living room or house or whatever, you got to bring that in because I think it's going to look very familiar to me. So
she had one of those record racks.
Yes.
That goes floor to ceiling.
Oh, I know the record rack.
And you put your Mantovani collections in it and spin it around.
Yeah.
And,
no, yeah. My grandmother had exactly the same console where it was like, and it was like it took up the whole wall, and it was about 4 feet high, went from one wall to the other, and then you would like lift up the top like. You know, like you were opening up a hope chest.
Exactly.
But it wasn't so much a hope chest. It was just a chest full of, you know, like the Reader's Digest mood music collection or something.
And my grandmother subscribed to Reader's Digest and bought Reader's Digest condensed books.
Of course.
So many of my classic book reading was done in summers visiting my grandmother when there was nothing to read but Reader's Digest condensed books.
I read many, many, many Reader's Digest condensed books when I was a young lad, and I didn't really know that they were shorter than normal books. I didn't really get the whole condensed thing. I thought it was, in my child's mind, I thought it was condensed meaning that they had just put them all in one place for you. In other words, in terms of space.
Me too. Yeah.
That, like, we've saved you the trouble of 4 books. We've shrunk them down or something. I didn't get that they had just taken whole wax. Here's a weird thing. Just a little side note. So you know what's really, really strange is that for the zombie economics book in the contract you signed, it actually had little provisions in the contract for both book of the month clubs, for book of the month clubs, for Reader's Digest, specifically noting that no condensation or condensed version of the work was to be released or sold without express consent of, you know, blah 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 blah. What was the other thing? It was Reader's Digest. It was like Book of the Month Club, and then like large
publisher's
print
clearance
edition or something. Or it might have been that, actually. It might have been like a Publisher's Clearinghouse sort of a thing. But it was weird, and it was like, I didn't know if they still actively did that or if they just had never modified their contracts, like since like 1972. And here's the thing about the Reader's Digest condensed book thing being in the contract. That was actually a little bit of a vindication for me, because Lisa Desjardins and I at one point had actually had not even really an argument, just this sort of, she insisted, and I think still insists, that Reader's Digest is, quote, a West Coast phenomenon, and that people in the rest of the country wouldn't know what that was.
Really?
Yeah. Because there is actually in the book itself, in the actual story section of Zombie Economics, there is a reference to Reader's Digest. I refer to something, blah, 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 a stack of year-old Reader's Digest. And she was, you know, we would mail our manuscript back and forth. And at one point, she sent it back to me with a note in the margin going, Reader's Digest. She's like, I don't think anybody outside of the left coast will, she didn't say the left coast. She said, I don't think anybody outside of the west coast will understand what that is. And I said, everybody knows Reader's Digest. And she said, I think that's just your part of the country.
The condensed books stopped publishing in 1997.
Okay, so I don't really need to worry about that.
No.
I'm sorry, I won't be given that opportunity. That marketing avenue has been closed to me. The other thing she claimed is a West Coast phenomenon. She claimed two things that we referenced in the book were West Coast phenomenon and that people in the rest of the country wouldn't know what they were. One was Reader's Digest, just period. Mm. And the other was the notion of a rendering plant. Because look, you don't have to tell me, sister. I'm on your, Rick Emerson's on your side.
By the way, Reader's Digest was originally based in New York. So,
I'm just saying, these are all things that I know. But there's at one point, there is a...
Its headquarters are now in New York City.
There's a phrase or something that says, smells like a rendering plant. And she, again, a little note in the margin, she goes, maybe it's, she's always so, like, she's basically just does everything as though she were, like, those two little stuffed dolls that follow Duckman around, Fluffy and the other one, and they just, you know, they have little bells and chimes and, the, you know, Mr. Duckman. But she would say, I think rendering plant is another West Coast thing. I don't know that the rest of it, and I'm like, you know, the rest of the country is all just farms and dirt anyway. Of course they have rendering plants there. That's where you get rid of the hooves. So, all right. Let me just finish. Hey, is there an at Old Spice on Twitter, do you think? I mean, there's got to be, but I don't want to inadvertently reference the wrong. Can you
probably.
Quickly see?
Yeah,
before,
I'll look. Hold on.
Okay, while I write it. Attention, Old Spice. At DonTaylor666 and I have devised your next slogan. Old Spice and then...
It's Old Spice. At Old Spice. Old Spice.
Okay, and then ellipsis or dash... Or colon for the Old Spice smell like daddy.
Old Spice dash.
Okay, like an M dash?
Yeah.
All right. Old Spice M dash. Smell like daddy. Probably lowercase.
I think all capitals.
Okay.
Smell like daddy.
Yeah. Okay. Smell like daddy. Quote, period outside the quote. Wait. Yeah, period outside the quote. All right. Attention, Adult Spice. Don Taylor and I have devised your next slogan, period. Open quote, Old Spice, M dash, smell like daddy, close quote, period.
Yes?
All right. Okay, I'm sending this now to the horror of, like, everyone.
Well, let's see.
Okay. That's too late now. I've sent it.
Yay!
All right, awesome.
And then I'll retweet it, you know, because anything worth tweeting is worth retweeting.
Of course. It's worth over-tweeting, Don. All right. I'm sorry to everyone in the Defense Department who labored for like 20 years to build the internet so that we could communicate after a nuclear disaster of some kind, or that so you could talk to, you know, bombers in Russia and keep the world from being immolated in a cauldron of atomic fire. I'm just using that to make Old Spice jokes now, so sorry.
Yeah.
That's just the way that rolls. I want to form a band called Drugstore Perfume. All right. There should be a pulp novel called Drugstore Perfume. Okay, somebody do that. See, that's what I'm saying. I'm an idea man today, Don Taylor. I'm a man of ideas. Ideas come from this man. That's what today is all about. All right. Oh, final email from Seamus, and then we'll start some stuff here. Let's see here. Here's an interesting statement from Thomas Gill, which I believe. He says, I work with a guy who wrote a lot of the software that runs the internet. I don't even know what it means, and I know that I wouldn't understand the explanation, but I mean...
Thomas Gill invented the internet. It was him. It was not Al Gore. It was Thomas Gill.
You would not be surprised, though, if he just went, well, I don't like to
talk
about
it. Well, I was like 8 years old, and I was tinkering around in the basement.
I got two more cologne things, and then we'll read this other email from Seamus, and then we'll start the actual show. Not really. Because we seem to be channeling Don and Mike today, which we do a lot anyway. That whole opening where I played the Buzz Martin song is very Don and Mike-esque. I've been threatening to play this forever. I think I'll play it today. When I had Don and Mike record a motivational speech for the salespeople at CBS, and that went... I was ordered to have Don and Mike prepare a motivational speech for the salespeople, which went really, really badly. So we'll play that. And I think nearly got us sued. So we'll play that here in a bit. We got two people commenting about cologne here. One says... The entire Avon line equals horrible crap that reeks. No, that really is true.
Oh, yeah. No, that's absolutely true.
My Aunt Mary, she collected Avon decanters, always shaped like Elvis, if she could get them. And so I would have to go see her in, of course, Malala. And I would go to her house, and it just reeked. It was like the inside of that perfumery if it were, like, in a trash can in June. In the bottom of a sewer.
My mother, for whatever reason, my mother collected owl figurines.
Okay, my grandmother collected owl figurines.
Steve.
So you got to stop that, like now.
And one of the things, when she died, I was packaging up all the owl figurines, trying to figure out what I was going to do with them. Ultimately, I ended up like selling most of them on eBay. But one of them was actually a little collectible Avon thing that was an owl. It was a little white owl with gold eyes. And you unscrewed the top half of him, and it was a solid perfume inside the owl. And I was like, and it was still in there. And so I kind of like stuck my finger into the sort of desiccated stuff, and I held it up and I smelled it, and I was like, oh yeah, Avon perfume.
Okay.
I kind of screwed it back together and put it away. It was horrible.
I have exactly the same story. And I'm not, and I know that sometimes we talk a lot about the whole, like, you and I had very similar lives, and your dad, and my dad, but your grandmother, mine. I have exactly the same story because my grandmother collected owls. Owl everything. Owl potholders and things on the wall and paint knickknacks and figurines and bedspreads. Everything in my grandmother's house was owls. And, of course, and Avon was beloved by my grandmother and by one of her daughters, my Aunt Mary, and probably given to her by my aunt, frankly, there was the owl solid perfume decanter.
No!
And as I swear to God, I said, I have exactly the same story. I was like five. I didn't know what it was. And I opened, it's like a screw top owl. Why would you not open a screw?
Yeah.
There's going to be owl guts inside. No. I open, I'm like, what's this? Stick my finger inside, and it was like a hard cream.
Yeah.
Like a soft wax sort of thing.
Yeah, kind of a waxy sort of a thing.
And I went, what's this? Oh, God, it burns. You know, and then I just had to go run
horrible.
My hands under the water. And then I was, wrong owl, you know? And then I just went, and that was, I have exactly the same story. I swear to Christ.
Just bizarre.
If my mother was here in the room, she would back me up. She would tell you that is exactly what happened to me.
Ow.
I mean, that's, thankfully, my mother does not collect owls.
That is freaky.
Okay, wait a minute. Now, hold on. Does anybody in your family collect turtles?
No.
Okay, because my mom collects turtles. So,
no.
All right.
My mother decided that it would be good for me as a kid to be like somebody who collected something. I guess she always wanted to turn me into a little miniature fur, and it never really worked out. So for several years when I was a kid, I collected little mouse figures. I had little mouse statues and statuettes and figures.
My next door neighbor growing up in Kennewick, she collected mouse figurines. And I always wondered like how people decided. Like, how do you decide? Like, my mom, I asked my mom one time when I was a kid. My mom loves turtles, and she has, like, turtle everything. And I asked my mom, I said, what is your deal with turtles? And she said that, and at least she had an answer. I mean, when I was, like, five, I said, what is your deal with turtles? And she actually said, she said that, something very close, she said that turtles lived their lives the way that she wanted to be able to live hers. The idea that she was like, you know, that they had nowhere to be. You could tell. They didn't ever have to, what the hell that is.
Is someone calling us?
Oh, I think I've been retweeted, maybe. And
oh.
I think I've got another thing. But she said that she said, you can just tell. She's like, you look at a turtle. Does he look like he's in a hurry? Does he look like he has anywhere to be? And I said, no. She goes, does it seem like he has any stress at all? Does it seem like he's, you know, does it seem like his life is hectic? And I said, no. She said, okay. And also, he can just kind of nap whenever he wants because the bed is right there. And I went, all right. Now, but it's like owls and mice. Like, what is up with that?
I don't know. When you think about that my mother had owls and I had mice, then there's something really kind of twisted psychologically
Seriously.
Going on. My mother, I asked her once as an adult why she had collected owl things, and she really had no interest. She didn't know why. So I posited to her that perhaps she had had like an alien abduction experience and repressed it. And so it was like she was trying to sort of the repressed memories were trying of the big-eyed gray aliens was trying to get out through her obsessive purchasing of owl things.
Okay.
And she didn't.
She
didn't say no. I don't think she really quite bought it. But I thought as a theory it was interesting.
Let's see here. Somebody says maybe all owls are filled with waxy perfume. Let's go catch one. All right, let's see. I said it was going to wear a couple of the. Okay, so yes, horrible crap that reeks equals entire Avon line. Also, my dad didn't wear cologne. He only smelled like skin bracer by Menon.
My dad used skin bracer.
I think my dad.
I remember that,
Now, that was an aftershave,
yeah,
but it was like a toner.
Yeah, you'd shave and then you'd splash it on your face.
It was just alcohol,
go,
basically.
I go, ow!
Yeah.
And it made you feel manly, I guess.
Which is weird because it's like all perfume, at least, or cologne when I was a kid, it was basically just alcohol, and it all hurt. It was all painful.
Well, yeah, and it's like, that's not good for your skin
to
shave, you know, the top, like, layer of skin off and then put alcohol on it.
Because it dries it and it's a horrible, yeah. Let's see. And plus, like, the idea that, like, I guess if you're shaving with a blade covered in rust and E. coli, you know? Because really, otherwise, what do you have to sterilize your face for? If you have to sterilize your face, there are larger issues in your home. Let's see, we got like three more here. Michael says, well, comma, when did people wear Stetson? The answer to that is when you were Rick Emerson and you were like 14. I wore Stetson in high school.
I dated a guy who wore Stetson. He had this thing where he thought that Ralph Lauren was really classy. So he bought like the shirt. He wore the shirts with the little polo pony guy on it and that sort of thing. And he wore Stetson. And Stetson is one of those, there are some perfumes and colognes.
Is Stetson by Ralph Lauren?
Yeah, it's a Ralph Lauren brand. Yeah. And there's some of these perfumes and colognes. No, I'm sorry. He wore Polo.
Polo is the one, the guy and the horse.
I was confused, the Stetson and the Polo, because they smell very similar, actually. I did a guy who wore Polo. And it's, and much like the Stetson, it's one of those things that it, a good cologne, a good perfume actually will kind of change a little bit depending on your own personal body chemistry. Some, however, don't. They just smell the same no matter who's wearing it.
It's the ketchup of the cologne world.
Like Opium by Yves Saint Laurent, which was everywhere in the 80s. You could not escape it. And I wore that myself, by the way, during my younger years. Yes.
Good for you.
That was my dressing up and going out fancy perfume was Opium. But some things like the Polo and the Stetson just always smell the same on anyone. So you just immediately go, oh, I smell Stetson. And if you ever like dated someone that wore that or something, immediately it's like, I smell what's his name.
Exactly. No, well, that's my thing. Is like to this day, if I smell Stetson, it's like, oh, it smells like high school. Because that's, again, when I said it was like that, it was like the ketchup of the cologne world. Ketchup isn't meant to augment the flavor of a food. It's meant to hide the flavor of a food. And Stetson is like, well, if you reek or you just don't know how to, you know, you have no clue of how to pick and just wear this and, you know, it's one scent fits all. And it's dreadful. And I at one point, I think my mother trying to like sort of help me, you know, gain a little confidence as a young man in the world, you know, and my mother, to her credit, never. My mom, to her credit, she was very, very rarely, almost never, was she the embarrassing parent. And when she was, it's only because, like, that was actually just me. That was my person. In other words, she never really did anything embarrassing that I can think of, overtly embarrassing. I was sometimes embarrassed, but that was just because I was a jackass teenager. She never really did anything that was just overtly retarded or stupid. She, in fact, sort of, like, if she saw that I was sort of into something or if I was trying to, she would kind of assist. And so, like, one year, I think for Christmas, she's like, well, I see you wearing that Stetson from the Payless. So she got me, like, a Stetson gift set.
Aww.
And it was like Stetson aftershave, Stetson cologne, same thing, one slightly creamier than the other. Mm-hmm. And then Stetson soap, that was just ill-advised. First time you get Stetson soap in your eyes, that's a soap you're never going to use again. It's like delousing soap. And so I would just, and of course, you know, when you're a guy, you're like, well, I don't want to wear too little. I guess I'll err on the side of wearing too much. But then when I turned like 15 and a half or something and I got a job, I left the realm of men who wear Stetson, and I then entered the realm of men who wear English leather or nothing at all. And so I was like English leather guy for the remainder of my head. And then the coda to this whole thing is that the cologne that I actually like, for me, the cologne that I actually legitimately like, a cologne that I quite love, I discovered just as I realized it made me a douchebag to wear cologne. So I actually found something called XS, which is just the letters XS, which is really, really nice, which I like a lot. And I think I got it, and then literally like that same month I went, you know, every time I smell cologne on a guy, he's just a dick. Maybe I shouldn't wear this. And then I noticed that, like, this sort of cologne douchebag thing. And so it's, like, been in a drawer ever since then. I've never actually had a chance to really wear it anywhere.
Aww.
So, the end.
I like good smelling things, but I wear them sort of infrequently and such, and I, you know, watch what I do. Because I had that one experience where I had worn that one scent that Sarah really liked, and then she
bought
it.
Oh, the cookies and syrup or whatever?
Bouche de Noël, and it smells like orange cake. But the thing is, and then I came into your show one day, and you said, oh, we always know Dawn's here because we can smell you coming down the hall or something. And then I was like, oh, my God. Yeah. Apparently I reek, and I'm my smell is preceding me. So after that, it was like, you know, no. I backed off on it because I was like, you know, I don't like people smelling me. You shouldn't smell someone's cologne or perfume or anything unless you're, like, very close to them.
Yeah, no.
Unless you're within, like, a foot or so. Get actually into their personal space.
And if you enter the room after they've left, you should no longer be able to smell
it.
But you always can. So I just decided, not to be that guy. I didn't know that. Well, that's, you know, it was a nice scent.
I just get very self-conscious about that sort of thing. It's just, I mostly, my dream is, I think, to just essentially be
invisible. Yeah.
If I can't be fabulous and just be admired universally by everyone, I would rather just be invisible.
Well, you'll notice, by the way, that I, like my car, it's like, give me something small and gray and unobtrusive that no one will see. I mean, I basically have a car that can't, you really have to be like right in front of it before your eyes will even register my car. And then also, you know, maybe I'll just wear jeans and a dark t-shirt every single day for the rest of my life so that when I vanish, just when I leave the building, I just go and I just vanish into the humanity.
I still do like to smell good, though. And even though I have like all of these things that are scented at home, the one that I wear the most, like pretty much daily, is a body spray from Bath & Body Works that's just called like clean cotton or something. And it basically just smells clean. It smells like clean laundry.
Oh, that's nice.
And I just really like that because I can spray some of that on myself and just go, okay, now I smell like, you know, clean.
God, I just sounded really gay just then. Okay. Well, since I sound gay already, there's Victoria's Secret has this scent called, which is the thing that I would, you know, Victoria's Secret is typically, I mean, I think I speak for a lot of guys when I go, like, secret schmecret. I mean, like, I don't, the fact that something is from Victoria's Secret, like, doesn't impress me at all. But they had something called, a terrible name, it was a terrible pun, it was called Heaven Scent, which I actually liked quite a lot. And then they discontinued, here's the thing, this is why they're dead to me, they discontinued it the same month they retired my favorite Victoria's Secret model. So they can all die.
Just as a last note, I will notice also, I think we've talked about this before, the most compliments I ever used to get on perfume or cologne or something I wore was when I wore men's cologne. I used to wear Chanel for men because I had read somewhere that Greta Garbo wore Chanel for men.
Chicks who wear guy cologne, great.
And I picked it up and I read that, and then I was at a department store and I picked it up and I splashed some on and I walked around for a while and let it sort of meld and smelled it and went, wow, this is great. This is kind of like spicy and kind of cool and really nice. And so I used to wear that. And I got more compliments from men when I wore Chanel for men than anything else I've ever worn.
There's an obsession for men. I knew maybe this is less surprising. I know this huge butch lesbian who wore Obsession for Men, which the first time I'd actually smelled it, it was really nice. And then she had this other by Hugo Boss. There's this it's called Deep Red for Men, which was actually this is really the gayest I've ever sounded in my life. I mean, really, this is like 25 minutes now. I mean, he's talking about scents and, you know, and anyway. Thomas Gill wants it known. He says, you sterilize your face to prevent ingrown hairs. Of course, he says, I also use Axe Phoenix. Is Phoenix a different kind of...
I don't know. Is it? You spray it on, then you burst into flames?
Is that a Dungeons & Dragons reference that I'm not getting? Like, it's not an Axe body spray. It's like an Axe da-da-da-da. No, I got nothing.
It's the plus five body spray of holding or something.
I finally just had to end the opening music, but I will just say it's funny that this all comes up because I forget how we got onto the owl thing and the scent thing, but I guess it was because Seamus was talking about his Old Spice, so it all comes back around to his second email, which says, and this is actually going to lead us into a whole different conversation. I feel like I need to have some other piece of music playing underneath because we haven't actually even gone to the news desk. But he says. He got the zombie economics book, the retail book. He said, I opened my retail zombie economics package from he ordered it online. He said, I opened my retail zombie economics package and sniffed the hell out of it. That book smells so good. He says, yes, I sniff books. Come on. You know they smell good.
Yeah.
All those chemicals to produce the pulp and bind it in the ink. If I were rating zombie economics on smell, I'd give it 5 out of 5. I haven't purchased the Kindle version yet, but I'll tell you how that smells later. And that is a thing.
Brand new trade paperbacks smell really good.
I thought that's a thing where it's like, I didn't think it was just me, but I thought that maybe I was in the tiny minority of people who go, the smell of a book. You know what else smells really great? Do you ever write something on those office sheets where it's like an invoice sheet where there's the yellow copy, then the green, or then the white copy, then the pink copy on the bottom?
Yeah.
And it's the like tissue paper multicolored, but so it's like carbons. That stuff smells fantastic. Okay, so let's quickly do this. I gotta find some additional piece of music here. Hold on, I just can't hack the silence is driving me mental here.
Other things that smell good.
No, we're gonna do. No, but it's not just that, Don. Hold on a second. Let's see. Where's my? Let's see. I'll have.
You have an olfactory theme.
Well, I was just gonna do the Blackula thing again, but Here's what I've got basically. I've either got Blackula, or I've got Fanfare for the Common Man. I don't think I have anything else. Oh wait, hold on. No, I have this. No, wait, I have this here. Hold on a second. This will be our. We'll do this so we don't have to use the. Because what did we set Blackula? That was the Black Signal. if we needed an explanation of urban culture. Right. We'll just do this again. All right, so this will be our... Okay, so Seamus says, if I was rating Zombie Economics on smell, it would be a 5 out of 5. We were talking about the book, the office thing. So let's just quickly do this. So please now name for me two, if you can, but we'll accept one. Something you enjoy the smell of, but something that is not marketed for its olfactory purposes. In other words, it's something odd, that maybe is not designed to smell good, where the smell is incidental, but you love it.
The smell of permanent markers, big fat, the big fat permanent markers. I love those. I love the smell of hot tar when they're fixing the streets.
Really?
I love that smell. What else do I really love the smell of that they don't market? Well, and then there's just the food thing, coffee. The smell of ground coffee before you actually make the coffee, just right out of the can, is just one of the best smells ever. And also, I always remember, and I'm not the only one, anyone who's old enough to remember the purple mimeograph sheets that you would get tests, and they would pass out the test, and everyone in class, you would pick your paper up and stick it to your face and smell your test before you would start taking it.
Absolutely.
That was a great smell.
It really was, and it had a weird, and plus they were always a little bit, they had that weird dampness going on as well. That paper was always the slightest bit soft, and you're like, what was that? It was like damp money on a summer's day. Here's the thing, you're talking about the coffee and the fresh ground, like the actual beans before you actually make them into coffee. Here's two things that don't smell anything alike. Cigarettes in the pack and cigarettes being smoked.
Yeah,
cigarettes in the pack. There used to be a briar shop, sort of a tobacconist or whatever when I was growing up in the mall or whatever. And they would have made this is I think an earlier time because they would just let minors wander in and just sort of like pick stuff up and it was just an entire store full of tobacco and pipes and whatever. And it wasn't like a head shop. It was literally like cigars and they had a humidor and they had the whatever, and it just smelled like the best thing. It's amazing that I didn't just come out of there with a pipe habit.
Pipe tobacco smells just great before it's smoked.
My dad smoked a pipe.
My dad smoked a pipe for a while too.
Trying to quit smoking.
And that maybe that's
strangely
why.
Strangely enough,
no. I think my dad just liked. He just liked props and gizmos.
I'm a sophisticate.
So he just, I think he just liked the idea of having a pipe because it was a toy.
You have a silver top cane with that too.
No, God.
A monocle.
But, I do, and that wasn't. I have to say, I do. I don't miss smoking because I quit smoking almost a year ago, but I miss clove cigarettes. And that was really the thing that got me to quit smoking, is that they outlawed clove cigarettes. The only ones you can get now are cigars, and it's cigar tobacco with the clove stuff, and it's not the same thing. But I miss that. I loved the smell of them in the package before you'd light one. I even like the smell of the smoke when you're smoking them. I miss clove cigarettes.
Okay, so I got three different points about clove cigarettes. It's clearly just going to be one of those days because it's already 2:30. We've been talking for an hour.
We'll probably take a pee break for the people sometime soon, and then
maybe we won't. So I got three things to say about clove cigarettes. One, okay, so you were. This seems foolish, even though we're glad you're no longer smoking because we're fond of you. But did you really quit smoking around the same time you started doing this show?
Yeah.
I'm gonna be working with Rick. Maybe I'll stop smoking at the same time. It's amazing that you didn't kill you and me and everyone. I mean, that is good. Well, stopping smoking is difficult for people.
I guess. I've quit before. I don't really have trouble quitting smoking. I never was actually addicted to the nicotine.
Is it the ritualistic aspect?
Yeah, I just really liked smoking. That's the thing. And I would get addicted in the case of, like, I found it soothing, and it helped me when I was, and still now it's like when Patrick was in the hospital, I bought a pack of cigarettes and I smoked like one, but it was like, I really want a cigarette. And then I was like, oh yeah, I don't like these anymore. But, it wasn't bothersome. It was just a matter of you couldn't get the actual real clove cigarettes anymore. And the ones that are piped to cigar tobacco give me a headache. Patrick hated it, but he's been trying to get me to quit for years. But then I was doing this, and I figured, better for my throat, for my voice, for my lungs to not be smoking if I'm going to be talking all day for a living.
So you did the opposite of most people who were like, I'm going to get into radio, got to mellow my voice out. I better start smoking a carton of cigarettes a day.
Well, I'd been smoking at that point, actually, really seriously smoking for a couple of years. And honestly, if it wasn't affecting my voice, if it hadn't lowered my voice and made it sultry by that point, it wasn't going to happen.
So. I knew a voice guy, one of those guys who would just sit in a booth all day and go like, Rock 102. And he was, you know, this guy who, you know, he didn't look like a guy who was possessed of a, but he, a huge voice. But he didn't. And I actually saw him out back, literally, the actual literal chain smoking of like lighting one off the other in the parking lot. And I was like, hey, you changed. I didn't say like chain smoker, huh? But I said something about like, I think I actually said like, that's the first time I've actually seen somebody doing the actual chain smoking. And he goes, I gotta keep this moneymaker in tip top condition. And like, that was his thing, is like he started smoking to mellow his voice. So how is it? So did you use clove cigarettes to help stop smoking regular cigarettes? Were they like an interstitial thing, or was that all you really smoked?
No, that,
and when they got rid of those, you're like, well, what's the point? I might as well just, you know.
Yeah, no, that's basically why I became a smoker.
Was because of cloves.
Because of clove cigarettes. I had smoked off and on like 15 years ago. I had smoked, you know, when I've told this story before, when I went into rehab for an eating disorder. And the only vice we were allowed while we were in rehab is people who were smokers were allowed to smoke.
Right.
And so I took up smoking because I'd given up caffeine and I wasn't doing drugs and I wasn't allowed to eat junk food. And I was locked up for a month in a hospital. So I was like, but they'll let us smoke.
Awesome.
So, okay, give me one of those. You know, I needed something. So, and then I smoked for a while then I quit again. But yeah, so I took it up a couple of years ago because I was hanging out with someone who smoked clove cigarettes. And I had smoked them before, but she smoked clove cigarettes.
Was that someone, my wife?
No.
Okay.
But she smoked clove cigarettes, and they'd come over like about once a week or so, and I started smoking them, and I was like, man, I like these. And that was really it. I just really liked them.
Here's the... Keelan has armed us with another piece of music. I didn't know if I was supposed to mention this or not. He'll have to let me know if I can mention that he's got a new project that is I think partially available. I don't think you can get the whole thing yet, but maybe you can. Anyways, but he's got a suite of songs, a work that he has created, which is awesome, by the way. So this is part of that. This is perfect for the clove cigarette discussion, because now it sounds like we're in a German expressionist club, heading down to the sex dungeon. Come with me, mademoiselle. Taste life.
Is this Keelan's sex dungeon music?
Well, sort of. Just as a side note, I was actually about to email him. I ran out of time for the show, but I'm gonna see if he can actually come into the studio sometime soon and talk about his record that he's going to be putting out, which is. I don't know exactly. I've been so busy this week. I don't really know like what's out and what's not and what has been discussed elsewhere and what hasn't. But it's quite unlike anything you've ever heard. I'll put it that way.
Well, this sounds like great soundtrack music. I listen to a lot of soundtrack music when I'm working because I can't write and listen to things with lyrics at the same time. So I listen to a lot of soundtrack music. I would listen to this while I was working.
I'm not just saying this. He's a massively talented individual, and you know, and is.
Oh, I can imagine.
You know what I'm talking about. But I have the last project that he did was this sort of duo or collective, this sort of down tempo collective, not unlike this. It's called Azure Noir, which is him and a female vocalist. And I actually have the regular version, and I have the instrumental version of that album too, because it's a lot like this. And this is a lot of the stuff that I listen to if I'm working. Sometimes I can use lyrics, but a lot of times it's got to be instrumental, and so I use a lot of like down tempo electronica stuff if I'm writing. He's got the single is out, by the way. It's on iTunes. It's called Plasma Shells. This is the instrumental version of that. Plasma Shells, full album, June 7th. We'll talk more about it. We'll get him in the studio because it's awesome.
Okay.
It is a. I swear to you, and I'm not making this up. Literally, it's a sci-fi epic. It's this massive multi-part sci-fi adventure. In music form, it really is. It's wonderful.
This actually is terrific, and I'm not just saying that because you know we like Keelan, but this is.
No, it's
this is
really
terrific.
It's good. I'm gonna try to get here in the studio to talk about it. But here's the thing about cloves. The reason I ask if it was my wife that you were smoking cloves with, because she, you know, and she actually doesn't. She doesn't smoke regular cigarettes. Never has. That is one thing where the Mormon raising sometimes does pay off, because they guilt you through the formative stages where you might start experimenting with some of those things. And so I think she was successfully. I think if she had not been raised Mormon, she probably would have started smoking as a teenager, because based on some of the things based on some of the things that she gravitated to when she left the church, I think she probably would have...
Dating disc jockeys?
Yes, exactly. I think she probably would have rebelled by smoking cigarettes, but that was a thing that was like just... That was like that and drinking. I mean, drinking alcohol and smoking cigarettes and premarital sex, those are like the three, you just didn't under any circumstances. And I think most people... Not everybody, but I think most people start smoking when they are maybe in their late teens, early 20s. And that was, she still had enough of the residual church in her that she wasn't going to do that. So she actually doesn't smoke regular cigarettes. She does smoke cloves every now and again.
I know, because I've been places when I was still smoking them, and her eyes would get big. She goes, can I have one of those? Like every single time. Can I have one? Well, certainly, Laura. And then I just sort of felt like I was... enabling her
no,
to
it's,
be bad.
That is, that's she's an adult. It's the thing she does. But the weird thing is, she went back to Utah just 2 weeks ago, and they still sell clove cigarettes in Utah.
Damn it.
Is that? But, they don't sell them in Oregon. They sell them in goddamn Utah. You can buy clove cigarettes. So she may have actually, who knows, she might be able to, let me just put it this way. Let me just be honest.
She can hook me up.
If you need her to mule some cloves for you, she can probably do it.
Patrick would be very annoyed. He's so pleased with the fact that I'm not... first of all, I'm not spending the money, because cigarettes are expensive. And clothes are actually more expensive than regular cigarettes.
They're like $14 in New York.
They're ridiculously expensive. And then, he just hates it. And he hates it. I think his mom finally quit smoking, but one or both of his sisters smoked. And so he grew up around smoking, and he hates it. He just hates it. So,
well, somebody says, what are these Jarum cloves I bought in Oregon?
They are flavored cigars.
So they're not actual cloves. It's like a pseudo clove.
They're a little bit thicker, and they're made with cigar tobacco, and they're sold as cigars. Oregon outlawed all flavored cigarettes. So they are a different, it's still the same clove flavoring, but it's a different kind of tobacco. And the cigarettes themselves are just a little bit thicker, so they can be classified as cigars.
Not that anybody else in the audience, and certainly nobody in this room, ever had experiences like this. But when she was out on her own living as a young woman in Utah, and she was 20, 21, 22, and breaking away from the church and living on her own and drinking deep from the cup of life. This is really what would pass for rebellion. She would go to a coffee house, or occasionally just a pizza place in Salt Lake. And she said that she would sit outside and she would sit there and smoke a clove while writing poetry in her journal, often about the patriarchy and about how it was her destiny to throw off the shackles of male oppression and so forth. But actually, I've got these great, really charming emails from her from when we first knew each other, where she's like, "Well, I was just downtown smoking a clove and writing about trees, or whatever she was doing." But every now and again, she goes back to Utah. So I'm not saying that that she could bring some back for you, but I'm putting it out there because it's a free society.
Yeah.
I'm just making you aware that you have free agency, as the church says. It's up to you. All right, we really should quit now. I didn't really list anything that... I was just going to say that I think, like most people, I find the smell of wooden matches when they've been burned, when they've been blown out, that sulfury smell. Big fan of that. Also, and it's probably doing something horrible to your lungs, but the... not just new books, but the moldy smell of a bookstore, like an old-ass bookstore.
That musty smell, yeah.
Where it's like just walls and walls of paperbacks that are just crammed in there and have been there for like 50 years. That's a great smell.
One of the perfume oils I have at home from this place, Black Phoenix Alchemy Lab, and they do hundreds and hundreds of different theme smells, three theme scents, and they have a whole theme section of H.P. Lovecraft scents. And
of course they do.
Well, yeah. And one of them is Miskatonic University, and it's the smell of dusty books, and it's got with the overlay of coffee and like whiskey, a little bit of whiskey. So it's like as if you were reading old books in an old library while drinking an Irish coffee. It's a really interesting smell. I'll bring it in so you can smell it. It's really interesting to smell that in a bottle.
So wait, so it's not, so this is, it's a cologne or it's a...
Yeah, it's a perfume oil. They come in like these tiny little bottles of very highly concentrated perfume oil.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
That's the sort of thing that you, see, that's the thing you could probably wear and people would, that is the thing that people might actually stop you and just say, what is that?
Yeah, I've worn it a lot. It's like the coffee smell actually wears off fairly quickly, but that musky book smell stays for a while and it's very weird to catch that smell coming off of you.
Then you can pick up chicks who want to bang their professors.
Yeah.
That's totally what that did. All right, can I just tell you that I had written down here at the top, briefly mention smell email. There you go.
Well, briefly in the Rick Emerson universe.
It's all relevant.
Is, you know.
I should mention a little bit of business here. So it is unbelievably almost 3 o'clock. Tomorrow, Mr. Big Jim Willig will be in the studio with us for another installment of Humor Me Comedy 101. Tomorrow, we'll be talking about the life, legacy, and work of the Marx Brothers. So that is it tomorrow, the Marx Brothers, Humor Me Comedy 101 with Big Jim Willig. Tonight, which means I think it goes up around 10 o'clock tomorrow morning, I'm going to be the guest on Geek in the City Radio. That is happening tonight, so I'll be over at Shea Duran taping Geek in the City Radio. And then that is available at geekinthecity.com as a direct download tomorrow. Again, that's Friday around 10 a.m. Or it's at you can subscribe at iTunes as well. I believe you put in Geek in the City and iTunes, you'll be able to subscribe. So that's tomorrow around 10 a.m. You'll be able to hear that and so forth. You looked surprised at something.
Yeah, my clown watch was not a new clown watch. It was an old clown watch. So
now it's just Nazis and penises.
Now it's just Nazis and penises. Well, there's also a corpse watch, too, but I don't know if we'll get to it. So.
This has nothing to do with smells. Final email, because I want to get it read.
Okay.
Because you know we're here to we're here to be for each other in the good times and the bad. Don.
Good.
This I don't even know if I should give the name. I won't say who it is. I'll just say that someone, and then if they want to be identified, they can let me know. Someone sends this email. Mm-hmm. I'm having a terrible, horrible day. But it just went a degree lower into hell when a customer just asked me, when my baby is due, I'm not pregnant.
Oh.
F my life.
Oh.
Sorry about that. Let's see. All right, well, let me just fade this out. We'll do a little, do you need to, honestly, do you need to use the facilities?
No.
Okay, because, I can do that right now. All right, let me just close this. Close and awesome. All right, at the news desk, look over there. It's Don Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
Let's do our Nazi watch.
Oh, it's so complicated. All right.
Oh, no.
Is your Nazi watch for Thursday on the Rick Emerson radio program.
The 10-year-old son of a white supremacist leader told investigators during questioning that he intentionally shot his father with a handgun inside their Riverside, California home.
Well done.
Riverside police were still verifying the boy's statement as to what happened when Jeff Russell Hall was shot and killed at about 7 a.m. Sunday. The shooting had nothing to do with the 32-year-old man's neo-Nazi's political activities with the National Socialist Movement, Lieutenant Ed Blevins said on Tuesday. Blevins said, "We don't want to say a motive until we can verify what occurred. We believe it was an intentional act. We think we know what happened, but tomorrow it could be something completely different." The boy, the oldest of Hall's five children, was expected to be charged with murder. Police have not yet released the boy's name. The district attorney was scheduled to interview the boy this week.
So the kid said it had nothing to do with the fact that dad is a Nazi, but they don't know that that's the real story.
Yeah.
Okay. So did the kid give some alternate explanation? Did he say, like, it really was because?
Well, he's one of two children from the guy's first marriage.
It seems like a stable home life and all.
Yeah. And they're all living in a home that belongs to the Nazi guy's second wife. The shots were fired. Police responded at 4 o'clock in the morning on Sunday and arrived to find Hall inside the home with a single bullet wound to his upper body. There was no reported argument leading up to the shooting, and police believe that it occurred immediately before someone called 911. They found the pistol that was used in the shooting along with a rifle. They found the pistol under a bed. So the kid was like, crap! And then, you know, I guess hit it under the bed or something. Police had responded to a number of complaints about protesters at the residence demonstrating against Hall's activities with the National Socialist Movement. Hall was the Southwestern State's regional director for the organization, which promotes white separatism. He gained national notoriety last year when he ran for Western Municipal Water District, garnering only over 25% of the vote. On websites, Hall listed meetings held at his home on the last Saturday of every month and drew an organized protest last spring from counter groups. He also frequently led patrols at the U.S.-Mexico border against illegal immigrants. But anyway, yeah. And for some reason or another, his 10-year-old son shot him.
Separated from life. Keelan notes, it's a good thing the white supremacist got his guns before Obama took them away. Here's the thing about guns is guns, in many ways, that having guns just sort of available and legal is not unlike the whole thing of just making, you know, of just putting big barrels of crack on street corners. That to some I mean, there will be collateral damage from those things, but to some degree, that is a sort of that's a circle that closes itself, I think, at the end of the day sometimes. So, you know, okay, look, occasionally you just learn early on in your life. My family is probably going to take me down the wrong path. I need to intervene now and try to forcibly alter my destiny.
Let's just stop this right here.
Yes, Dad, I'm sorry. You've chosen poorly. Better luck next time. All right, there's your Nazi watch for Thursday. Awesome.
I just like hearing this song as often as possible.
You know, when I was a kid, I had the biggest crush on that hot chick that was Colonel Klink's secretary.
Oh yeah, the blonde
Inga or lady. Olga or whatever yeah. the hell yeah. Swiss Miss girl. By the way, a little breaking news here. Hold on a second. Where's my little breaking news from Chief of Staff Cheryl Kanakoa, our woman in the street. She says Ross Island Bridge shut down due to police activity. Maybe it's a jumper. All right,
well, thank you for pointing that out, because now I know not to go that way to go home later. Although we're going to be here for a really long time, I think.
Oh, my God. Possible suicide attempt. You're going to have to jump 5 or 6 times, pal. You have to jump and then have them throw you off a few more times.
Bobby and I were just talking yesterday. We were talking about somebody going over the bridge.
From where would you jump?
Well, no, I was talking yesterday on Ham-Fisted Radio. I was talking about how I'd been driving across the Ross Island Bridge, and there was one of those asshats, like big muscular asshat, going, "Look at me! Look at how beautiful my muscular torso is, shirtless on his bicycle on the little bit of sidewalk going across the Ross Island Bridge." Of course, sitting straight up and not holding onto the handlebars.
Right.
And every time I see somebody like that, I'm just completely terrified. They're just going to hit a bump, wobble, go flying in front of my car, and I'll run over them.
That's the thing, is I don't care. Yeah, I don't care about them getting hosed. I care that they're going to get hosed and tip off in front of my car.
Yeah, and so, you know, and then that's traumatizing to me because I've just hit somebody with my car. Then I'm going to probably have to pay the guy's, like, medical bills, and it's horrible. And I'll have no sympathy for him because he's a big idiot. So Bobby asked me, like, but what if the guy, like, hit a bump and then went the other way and went over the railing, you know, into the water, would I still be as traumatized? I was like, no.
Well, no, because then it's just like, can I pull over in time to watch?
No, I'd just be like, well, I said I'd be like shocked to go, oh my God, I can't believe that just happened, and keep watching in my rearview mirror as I continue driving, because, hey, I got to be someplace in 10 minutes. And I figure, you know, it's like, what am I going to do, stop? I can't save him.
Right,
somebody else will stop and call 911. It'll be fine. So, yeah, I would just be surprised and shocked by it, but certainly not traumatized. I just, and then my next thought would be, oh, he deserved it.
No, that is it. You know, that's it. Look, sometimes, sometimes you're the ringmaster. Sometimes you're, sometimes you're the audience, Don. And, okay, well, I am posting this now.
It's hilarious. Not hilarious, but it's weird. We were talking just yesterday about somebody going off the Ross Island Bridge, and here today, it's like I manifested it. I hope it was that guy on his bike.
Let's see. Hold on a second. I'm sorry to be this guy. So anyway, then, that's all very interesting. I'm putting up at rickemersonshow.com right now a link to a live camera that will let you see the guy on the Ross Island Bridge. It's courtesy of Cheryl. Okay, go to rickemersonshow.com right now. You go to rickemersonshow.com right now. It is, by the way, it's Thursday, May 5th, if you're listening to this. rickemersonshow.com. That is rickemersonshow.com. And there'll be a link that should take you directly. It's actually called just Ross Island Jumper Bridge Cam. So you can go there right now and you can see the thing.
Ross Island Jumper Bridge Cam.
Oh, bastards. Now they're zooming the camera back. This camera was zoomed in, but now it's pulled back. People are tweeting about it. You know, we're not too far from there is the thing. I'm just saying. Let's see.
See, that's
open the curtain like I could see it.
This is one of those times when we need an intern. We could send him over and he could be reporting live via cell phone.
All right. If anybody, let's see, yeah, if you are there nearby, if you are in the general vicinity and perhaps listening or headed there or whatever, yeah, you just let us know what seems to be going. Not like you can get onto the bridge, but I'd be curious to know like how far back it's blocked for one thing. So if you are just joining us, that's the Ross Island Bridge, apparently now closed. That's 2:52 p.m. on Thursday the 5th. Some jackass pretending he's going to jump. I give you like 9 to 1, not going to jump. 10 to 1, will jump, be somewhat injured. That doesn't really work. However you do the odds. You know what I mean? It's like a 90% chance, though. I mean, it always just ends with him going like, well, okay.
Yeah, I can't see anything here except for just traffic back then.
Yeah. He always just begins blubbering, and then the cops have to sort of, you know, it's all right, and then they have to get him in the big bear hug and pull him over. But yeah, but even, I mean, really, it's like, even if he jumps, it's like, that's, you're not going to kill yourself jumping from there, right? I mean, unless you hit, like,
it
exactly
might.
Wrong.
Yeah.
The Ross Island Bridge, I don't think it's that, I mean, I don't.
Well, you figure, it's like jumping onto concrete, jumping onto water from any
Now, that's
any
only
height.
If you hit flat, though.
Yeah.
If you like, jackknife in or whatever, if you hit standing
you might,
up.
Yeah. You might hurt yourself pretty bad, but you could probably live if you, you know.
I mean, that's yeah.
If you landed feet or head first.
Yeah, I mean, if you hit flat, that'll certainly. I mean, you're gonna do some damage. You're gonna break some bones. But you know, I don't ever, not once in my life ever, have I bicycled across the Ross Island Bridge. There's no way. There's not enough money in the world because I've been bicycling where. You know, and I am a responsible bicyclist. You know, if I bike, I stop at red lights. I stop at stop signs. I'm not some jackass that just whizzes through intersections thinking that I am impervious. I don't ever bike without my helmet. And for that reason, I don't ever go across Ross Island Bridge because I can tell you, as careful as I am, I actually have had incidents where the wind or just a patch of water that I didn't see sneaks up on you and literally has just knocked me over. There was once I was actually here. This is terrifying. Everybody has a story, so I won't belabor the point, but I will just say that I was on front one time during rush hour in the afternoon, and I had the right of way. I mean, I had the cross, but I was getting ready to cross the street, and there was some small patch of something in the street, patch of water or something, but my bike turned just the right or wrong way, and I caught and I pitched off my bike under the handlebars just as the light turned green. And a guy just wasn't looking down and went, green light, mashed on his – and I literally had to like wait, throw my hands up like so he could see me.
Oh, wow.
Because he would have just ran right over my legs. And so because of that, I don't ever – because you can go from biking to being on the ground waiting to be hit in like half a second.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I talked to somebody I knew dumped their bike in San Francisco because they're riding somewhere down.
Thank you for not singing that.
And their thanks. And their bike tire had gotten caught in a track.
Track. That's the worst.
And went over. And apparently that happens frequently in San Francisco. A lot of bike riders. Lot of streetcar tracks.
If you're parallel with the tracks,
yeah.
That's what happens.
And so I thought about that. So then I was on my way down. I can't remember what street it is. But it's kind of over by Cascadia and by where KUFO was, and going straight down, and the actual road you're driving on is the streetcar track.
Mm-hmm.
And I was on that hill, and I stopped heading towards the light to go to Front Street. It was raining, and there were these people on bikes, and they were going across to go over to get into the left-hand turn lane, and just driving very slow. And I had that thought in my head about people on bikes getting their tires caught in the tracks.
Yeah.
So I was driving really slowly and giving them a lot of distance. And honest to God, a guy did it. He was driving down and he turned his bike just so his tire got caught in the track and he went down like in front of my car. And thankfully, I had actually been thinking about the San Francisco thing. So I was way back and not driving very fast. But I was still shocked to go, oh, crap, he actually did fall over while I was thinking, I hope he doesn't fall over.
Because they never realize, like, you know, they always say that stopping distance is like, you know, they say if you're traveling 65 miles an hour and you sneeze, you're blind for 100 yards because your eyes take that long to refocus. But that's why I was talking about, like, I fully expect that I'm going to be driving by the Hawthorne Theater one of these days and I'm going to kill somebody because it is going to be some drunken showgoer and he's going to step off the curb like an idiot right in front of me and there will be no time to stop. None, zero, because I'm at a big metal box going like 50 miles an hour.
I've had now we're just telling like driving stories, but
we're just waiting for the guy to jump. I mean, we're just killing time.
I've had occasion twice this week to go downtown to drive down to the Old Town,
mm-hmm.
and through Old Town. And both times, it's like every time I go to Old Town, I'm always still taken aback by the fact that the hobos in Old Town just cross the street as if they're daring you to hit them.
Yeah.
It's like they just feel like they sort of own this neighborhood and therefore don't ever have to look or even take traffic into consideration. They just walk.
And
they
I just
blithely walk into the street.
I've never seen that in any other city either. The homeless guys just walk across the street with impunity. And you, it is right. You're right. It's like they're almost like on the Serengeti plane where they make eye contact with you sometimes to go, yeah, hit me. See what happened. Hit me. And I think that is like, I think that's the deal of like, if you have very little power in your life, you just take your pleasure where you can. And that's a little tyranny that they can exercise because they know that in a city like Portland, you probably won't hit them. I mean, you try that like you try that like you know, like in L.A. They're going to be hosing you out of a grill.
No.
So, but I think in Portland they know that we probably won't kill homeless people. Let's see. So now the camera's just following a homeless guy. Speaking of which, as he walks across the bridge, Cheryl says the camera guy's screwing with everybody by just zooming in and out. I wonder if there's a person running this camera or if it's automated. It might be automated.
There we go. Oh, I see. Is that the guy?
I don't know. I can't quite tell. There's like some Kenny Powers guy, like in a red shirt.
Yeah.
Somebody says,
I guess there's and a couple of guys who are probably cops. I guess probably talking to him.
Oh, this is interesting. Thomas Gill says now he might die if he jumped, but not for the reason you'd think. He would hit the bottom. His feet would stick in the mud, and he wouldn't come back up. So he'd hit the bottom of the river, and he'd be lodged in the sediment, in the silt.
I have no idea how deep the river is.
Or hit the island on the south side of the bridge.
Yeah.
That's we've heard a lot. Or those brambles too.
Yeah.
That you can hit.
He looks like he's pretty solidly in the middle of the bridge, though.
Let's see. People are weighing in about the relative velocities with which you would hit the water.
Well, the guy in the red is I guess he's a traffic guy or something because he's just walking around in the middle of the road.
Yeah. No.
So we are doing a radio show about us watching something.
Well, I'm just
on video.
I'm just saying it's intriguing. So nothing appears to be happening.
No.
So apparently nothing has really happened yet. But the camera is live, not automated. So if the guy does look like he's gonna, you know, hurl himself into the void, we'll screen cap it for you.
Okay.
There you go. Were we doing news?
We were doing news.
We'll have more details on the jumper. I barely knew her. Blah blah blah. That here in just a minute.
A homeless man has been arrested for moving out of a dumpster because he officially listed it as his address. Charles Mader, what town this is in? For some reason, I lost the actual city. But fellow Charles Mader registered as a sex offender. Oh, it's Albuquerque. So he has to notify Albuquerque authorities within 10 days if he moves. In 2000, he was convicted for trying to rape a six-year-old boy. When he was released from jail, he had nowhere to go, so he listed the dumpster on 8th and Central as his place of residence. Deputies from the county sheriff's office began searching for him on Monday when they realized he had been absent from the dumpster for more than 10 days. They said they were particularly concerned because they'd received reports saying he had been checking out young children. The five officers eventually tracked him down to a homeless shelter nearby after following a tip-off from one of his acquaintances at a soup kitchen. He told them he'd been staying in an abandoned apartment across the road from the shelter. According to deputies, he had already violated the terms of his registration as a sex offender twice before. They say they're frustrated because they've told him over and over again not to move out of the dumpster.
I guess, well, it's that thing of like, you know, you must have a permanent address. And I mean, you know, it's not like the dumpster is going to be someplace different next month. It'll still be there. So
last month, he broke a requirement to re-register every 90 days and he's gone missing once before. He said he didn't understand the terms of the agreement. But Detective Pat Burke said he'd personally explained it at least a dozen times.
Well, I would imagine you have to explain something. If a guy lives in a dumpster, maybe his retention skills are not, like, top-notch. That may be. He may lack the mental acuity necessary. We're getting a lot of email about Reader's Digest. This email says,
really?
Reader's Digest is very popular in the Midwest, seems to be slowly turning into an organ for right-wing kooks who apparently like their reading material digested. Reader's Digest really is like a mother bird spitting stories into your mouth for you.
Well, Reader's Digest has always been, and the condensed books, are always popular with conservatives and with religious people because they're very family-friendly, they're very clean.
And there's art on the back, Don.
Yeah, the condensed books, they actually, in addition to making the books shorter, they also edited out the profanity.
Yes, that is true. When is the last time you saw or like actually picked up and read a Reader's Digest?
Actually read one? Oh, God, I was probably like 12.
So I was in
a Reader's Digest magazine?
Yeah.
It's still been a long time. It's been
God, 15 years.
You won't even recognize it as the thing. I was actually in Silverton, Oregon last year, maybe a year and a half ago, and Laura and I stopped at a little restaurant there for lunch. And here's one of those the ways that you know that you are with the right person. One of the small ways in which you know that you have you've found the person for you is that neither of us look down on the idea of, or in fact, the actual activity of reading during meals. So occasionally, and it's not like we don't enjoy talking to each other, but occasionally it's like she's got a book she's reading, I got a thing I'm reading. They're going to bring the lunch, and so we'll just sit there and we'll just be at the table reading. And but I had no – she was finishing, I think, some book, and I had no reading material with me. And I thought, well, good heavens. And so I went inside, and it was just like – it's like Field and Stream and Highlights and like everything you see in a diner in a tiny town. But then they had Reader's Digest. I'm like, aha, Reader's – I used to love this as a child. I would read Reader's Digest. And I took it back to the table and I swear to God, Reader's Digest has become – you know what it's become? Except in terms of dimensions, it's become Parade Magazine.
Oh.
Everything inside is like huge, bright red color pictures, and then every page, every article is like – every article is like the page. It's like the page of a Maxim magazine. I guess that's maybe the way to put it. Where there are no blocks of print any longer. There is not one page in that magazine that was actually just text. Everything was basically like a bunch of small blurbs or factoids shoved onto a page. Mm. It was like, and you know what I'm talking about when I say that it was like an entire page of pull quotes.
Yeah.
And all in different fonts, and some of them huge, and some of them really huge. None of them small, of course. And it was a whole lot of like, did you know? But it was like that was all the pages and the entire page.
That's so bad because I, as a kid, reading my grandmother's Reader's Digest, it was actually incredibly educational because there would be a lot of fluff stuff, but there would also be like health and science stuff.
Exactly.
There was that whole I Am Joe's, you know, body part series that they did. I remember being traumatized basically to the point where I still to this day remember this. And it may have had something, the early beginnings of my fascination with like creepy serial killer stuff and forensics. There was a story that they printed about a woman who was kidnapped. And while she was being held hostage, she was buried alive in a box that this guy had constructed underground. And they showed they described the whole thing she went through, and they actually had a diagram that showed how it worked, that this guy had built like a it was kind of like the episode of CSI that Quentin Tarantino directed. He'd built a plywood box, buried it underground. It had a fan and a vent that operated on a battery and a light, and he told her, it's like, look, you only have so much battery light, so you better, you know, be cautious about how much, like,
was this the drama in real life section?
The light bulb and the fan, and so she'd have to like turn it off, you know, and be in like complete darkness so that she was like conserving the battery. But she was
Family Magazine, Reader's Digest.
She was in there for like 3 days or something, and I read that when I was like, I think like 8 years old or something, and I was just like, why would someone do that to another person? That's the idea that someone could actually do that to, you know, me. Was just horrifying.
Now, see, this is not just a you and me thing. I think this is a generational thing and the particulars of it are such that they would be off-putting. So I will not describe the specifics here because it's just crap nobody wants to think about. But there was a particular drama in real life, except it wasn't drama in real life. Drama in real life is when somebody has survived something. Drama in real life would be like, kidnapped by a guy stuck in a box, or caught in an avalanche, or had to drink my own urine in the Amazon. It was like that was a thing where like something horrible happened, but like you survived. They were gripping stories of near death. They would also do not even like investigative pieces, but just sort of like kind of like crime blotter stuff. But you know, but like but it sounds wrong to call it human interest, but like the human story behind some crime. And there was this particular story. Which again, I didn't even want to go into, but there was a particular story about a gruesome murder that had happened, and which again, the same thing, just like scarred me, just traumatized me when I was a kid. I mean, I read it, and again, I mean, I'm a kid, and I'm like reading. Look at the humor in uniform, like college campus comedy or whatever it was. And
humor is the best medicine.
And then I read this. Oh, it's an inspiring quote by John Mellencamp. And then I read this article, and I was like, Christ almighty, or whatever I said when I was seven. I was like, what the hell? And actually, just like maybe 6 or 8 months ago, I was talking to – I think it was because of this conversation with Lisa about Reader's Digest being a West Coast phenomenon. And I was like, no, everybody read that. I went online and I was actually reading the Wikipedia entry for Reader's Digest just to see like if it was still around. And out of curiosity, I Googled – I remembered after all these years, I Googled the name of this article, which I still remember. And I remember, and I also remember the horrific – it wasn't a photo. There was a horrific sort of – for Reader's Digest anyway, kind of abstract painting of the victim.
They did that on the Drama with Real Life a lot too, where they would have these things about the guy battling the bear or the woman trying to get out of the car that was submerged in the ocean.
The artist's rendering of that situation. And I went and I Googled the name of the article, and the first few things that came up were people who were A, looking for that. They're like, hey, does anybody have the issue of Reader's Digest from like 1980? On the back, it had some petunias, and I don't remember what else. But they all said, because it had this one article that traumatized me, and I want to see if it was actually as bad as I remember it being. I think they wanted to do some weird exercising of it by reading it now and maybe seeing like maybe it's not so bad. But they were all looking for this article because they were like, God damn it, it just warped me, and I want to go back and read it so I can realize it actually wasn't so terrible. And it is weird how that kind of stuff was in, again, what was a family-friendly magazine.
Well, yeah, there was one that I remember reading as a kid that was a cautionary tale about, you know, kids don't chew tobacco, about a high school football player, and because he was an athlete, he didn't smoke because that would be bad for him. So instead, he chewed tobacco and always, like, you know, wadded it up and stuck it inside, you know, between his lip and his
pinched
gum.
Between his cheek and gum.
And ended up getting, like, face cancer and having to have, like, a big hunk of his face removed. And there was a photograph of him, like, what he looks like now with, like, half of his mouth and his jaw taken off, and it was a whole thing about, like, if I knew then what I know now, I wouldn't have done it, because look at me, I'm missing half my face, and I'm look at this going, ah!
They brought that guy to my, or a guy like that to my high school, a guy, no lower jaw. Not as bad as our friend from the mugshot the other day, but again, it was like, because they'd given him some sort of, but it's like, there's only so much to reconstruct there. I mean, your jaw's gone, you know? But yeah, he was totally like, I was wrong to chew tobacco, and he totally had, like, the whole, like, it was all, like, the waxy, like, plaster jaw. That was, you know, and I wasn't really going to be, like, doing it anyway, but that really is a thing where I went, I don't want that to happen. So, no, not for me. By the way, we want to give a big shouts out to the TriMet driver who just had to actually turn his bus around in the middle of the goddamn Ross Island Bridge. They actually were turning the traffic away, and a TriMet driver had to turn his bus around. So, turn the bus around.
And in regards to our earlier thing about the our Old Spice commercial, someone on Twitter mentioned that she told our friend Jesse Graff, who played Spock in Trailer Park, she told him once, I like hugging you. You smell like my dad, Old Spice and whiskey.
Creepy.
Creepy.
All right. Okay.
Okay.
Well, let's take a break, shall we? Not really because I need one, because I know that the people probably need one.
The people do.
Don't let that guy jump, like, until we get back. All right. Back after this. It is the Rick Emerson radio program. Stay right there. We return momentarily.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
shine up my old brown shoes. I put on a brand new shirt. I get home early from work. If you say that you love me, did-la, 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 see you crying.
Network.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
Well, I've done that. God damn it.
What did you do?
Yeah, that thing where all my cables are all intertwined and now my iPhone charging cables. Damn it. You know, here's the thing, and you would expect Apple to be better at, like, you know, we've talked about the headphone thing where your headphone cable is made of that, like, grippy material and so it all just gets itself in knots.
Yeah.
I mean, Sarah was just talking about that yesterday. I mean, she'll wind them and coil them and set them carefully, and then she comes in the next day and it's like they've just been it's like they're engaging in some sort of weird hermaphroditic self-sex with the headphone cables just knotting themselves up. And I was going to say, you'd think that that's one of those minor irritations that, like, Apple would fix, except my Apple headphones do exactly the same thing. Jesus. In any event, I was going to talk about Squire's Electric anyway, but seriously, I can't even plug the goddamn cable into the wall and then use it for like 5 seconds to charge my phone without screwing things up somehow. Well, in any event, Squire's Electric helps to make this fine radio program possible. Look, I mean, this is an hour-long discussion of perfume and daddy, you know, followed occasionally, you know, every now and again.
And clove cigarettes.
And a guy jumping off a bridge now and again. I mean, you know, these things, you know, don't just present itself. It's made possible by you, the Rick Emerson listeners, who help to spread the word and who daily contribute your 32 cents, for which we are much obliged and grateful, and also business partners such as Squires Electric. You can find them at squireselectric.com. SquiresElectric.com. That is Squires as in young Squires. Welcome to my hotel. My name is Lamar. SquiresElectric.com or Facebook.com/SquiresElectric. They are licensed, bonded, and insured electrical installers, contractors, and supervisors. Then come to your home or business and do really whatever needs doing.
Not anything.
I'm just saying, like, you know, maybe they come to do the electrical work and then you just, you know, you strike some sort of a deal and they, you know, they handle a guy for you. I'm not saying they're going to do that, but I mean,
it's so sad that you go that way, and I'm thinking they'll make you a sandwich.
Oh, I thought you were going. I thought you were going somebody. I thought you were going a different way with that altogether. But by the way, just this update brought to you by Squires Electric. Apparently, let's see, Ross Island Bridge should be opening soon. Police have wait for it. Yes, talk the jumper down. Nah, we all knew that would happen, jackass. Seriously, jump, don't jump. There is no try. I mean, I'm just saying. Look, we all want attention, friend. I mean, get a radio show. That's what the rest of us do. That way people don't have... That way people can opt to be annoyed by you. They don't have to be annoyed by you. In any event, what was I saying?
Squires Electric.
Squires Electric, yes. You were thinking they give you a hot oil massage, basically.
No, I was just thinking about a tasty sandwich.
Unclogging a drain. Or, yes, or sure, a bagel. Or, yeah, you know, maybe just, you know, dealing with someone who needs to be dealt with. These are all things you could probably, you know, negotiate because they're, you know, because they are the proud American business people, as are we all. So you can contact them at 503-252-1609, SquiresElectric.com. You can also go to Facebook.com/SquiresElectric. By the way, while you're there, will you do me this kindness and like Squires Electric while you're there? Go to Facebook.com/SquiresElectric and make sure you like their page. And if you haven't seen it yet, check out the photos. I swear to God, it's true. The photos from inside Lars Larson's old joint where he was broadcasting from. So they were there, and there's like the huge thing. There's just Lars next to what, like, some cable implying it's not to be touched or looked at. Anyway, so you can find out more by going to SquiresElectric.com. They make your life easier in all ways regarding wires or wiring in your home or business, and they're a proud sponsor of this, the Rick Emerson Radio Program. That's Squires Electric.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
I was trying to find the David Lee Roth, John Lennon jump thing. I'll close the... would have been too predictable to do earlier. I'll close the show with that. Don't forget to join us tomorrow when we'll be joined by Mr. Big Jim Willig for another installment of Humor Me Comedy 101. Tomorrow will be the Marx Brothers, their life and legacy. That is the where do you come down on the big Marx Brothers Stooges question?
Oh, Marx Brothers.
Yeah, me too.
I actually don't really care for the Stooges at all.
Yeah, me either. I mean, I respect them as important performers. Not really my thing, though. Not my cup of tea. You know, they are. Here's the thing: the Stooges are to the Marx Brothers as Wheel of Fortune is to Jeopardy. All right.
And just to preview this for future reference, in case you can't listen tomorrow, but why wouldn't you? On Monday, when we start our show, I will have just recently gotten myself all massaged and acupunctured. So we'll see.
By Squire's Electric?
No.
By who?
By Andrew Hill, chiropractor to the podcasting world. He's letting
a listener massage you?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I'm not judging. I'm just curious.
He is a professional. He's a licensed professional.
Oh, I see. So it's not just, you know.
No.
I like the way you talk. Can I rub you?
Yeah. He just keeps offering to rub me every time I see him. He's saying, let me rub you. Right. I rub Byron. Byron lets me rub. I've rubbed David Walker.
Well, yes, you know. Byron let me. Yeah, that's. I'm sure that's a limited group of people that Byron has let rub him. That's a small fraternity. So acupuncture and a massage.
Well, I'm not sure what he's going to do to me, actually. He asked me if...
It sounds better and better by the
I
moment.
I really don't. I've got like an hour and a half set aside with him, and I'm mostly talking to him about my like shoulders, my bad shoulder and my neck and stuff. But he had actually, you know, told me ahead of time that, you know, if I had a problem with acupuncture, you know, he could just do massage. I'm like, no, I'm fine with that. I'm not afraid of needles. I'm good with that. So I don't know what he's going to do. He could do the little smoke in the cup things.
Which is awesome.
He could do needles on me. It could be massage. I have no idea what I'm getting in for. But I just know that I should be feeling much more relaxed and happier probably on Monday when we start the show.
I've never had real acupuncture. I've only ever had, I had some limited acupuncture on Outlook Portland. And they just did like, you know, like my arms or something, which was, you know, that is one of those things that I don't disbelieve in it. But I know that it does not work for everybody or that it works in different ways. But I've been wanting to try it.
Yeah, I've never had it at all, so we'll see what
happens. Boy, you know, can I just tell you about, here's the thing about a massage. You know, they always do that thing of talking to women, you know, they do these surveys, these retarded news stories. Where they go, well, we polled 75 women and asked them if they felt that shopping was better than sex. Or they'll do the whole, like, what would you choose? They'll ask women what they would choose over sex. Mm. Notably, they never ask men that, but they ask women, they go, what would you choose? And it was like, women would choose, you know, like a spa treatment, or women would choose like a day of shopping, or they would choose like a trip to like wherever. And, you know, and but I would say this, though, that just speaking for myself, I would say that a really well done massage, like by somebody who really knows what they're doing, not just some jackass like get to mangle you, but an actual really well done massage. I don't know that I would go so far as to say that it is better than sex, but I would say that if it's done, the massage that is done well, I would call it, really, by somebody who knows what they're doing, I would say that is within shouting distance of being an equivalent. I mean, that really is like one of the great things in this world.
I think that's just a weird thing when people say that, though, about when they ask that question about what would you rather have instead of sex. And it's kind of like, well,
as opposed to what, though?
And again, it's contextual, isn't it? I mean, first of all, sex with who? And also, like,
well, again, that's why they ask.
You know, what kind of a mood am I in? You know, I mean, there are some times when, you know, I'm not interested in sex. I am interested in pizza, say, or something. You know, I would choose the pizza over the sex. Other times, sex I would prefer to have more than anything else.
You are demonstrating my remember what, like 10 seconds ago, and I said notably they never ask men, they always ask women, because women have gradients and facets and layers and textures, and men don't. Men are single celled organisms.
I don't think that's, you know, I see that. Yes, I think in general that is more true, but I don't think that's entirely true. I mean, the fact is that men, all men are not like always interested in sex all of the time. They're just not.
Well, no, but the survey didn't say like, are you ready to have sex now? The question was like, if you had the two things, you know, which would you prefer in general?
And I think men like to think that they are just like avidly interested in sex all of the time.
No, the empirical data proves that it is so.
Yes and no, though. No, I mean,
there's no yes and no. I mean, I can in like three steps. I mean, it can be. Now, I'm not saying there aren't exceptions.
Yeah, but I think if you actually talk to women, particularly women once they get into their 30s, they will tell you, particularly in long-term relationships, women's sex drive tends to be actually stronger and they want sex more frequently than their male partners.
Well, that just means, well, no, but that's a false standard. That you're just saying that that's just those guys wanting to have sex with somebody other than, you know, than her. That's all that is. That is not judging sex drive. That is judging sexual attraction to a specific person over a long period of time, which is not the same thing you were just talking about.
But if you just but the thing is, then again, though, that means that sex is contextual. It's not just sex.
Oh, no. Guys will still have sex. You know, they'll still do it because, again, it's like 2 a.m, 7-Eleven's all that's open. Limited selection, but nowhere else. So I'm just saying.
Well, tell that to all these women that are married to guys who don't want to actually, like, have sex. There are a lot of women who will tell you they are more interested in having sex more frequently than their partners.
I don't dispute that. But I mean, I don't dispute any of that. I guess what I'm saying is, as Tom Likas would say, it just means they don't want to have sex with you. I mean, that's really what – that's not to put too fine a point on it. I mean, that really is – that is really the bottom line, I think. And I mean
– and I will say once again, then that means it's contextual.
No, I mean, no. Because
otherwise it would be like, well, okay, I'll have sex with you,
no,
even
though
I don't want to. Because
you are assuming that all those guys are not having sex somewhere else, is my point. You're assuming that it's an either-or proposition. It's totally not contextual. You are assuming that it is a binary state. So that because those guys and those, you know, the woman says, I don't know, I want to have sex all the time, but Jeff, he's always just too busy. And you're assuming that Jeff is just going, well, it's sex with her, nothing. I'll take nothing. That's not really the way it works most of the time. And I think any divorce lawyer would probably tell you that that's the case. So, I mean, look, I don't know. I'm just saying nature seems to be wired up a certain way. Stephen Fry, though, is actually the one that I was thinking. Stephen Fry has made a lot of these points. He had an essay a couple months ago that got him in a lot of trouble because – and, you know, Stephen Fry's a gay man. And he was weighing in on his thoughts on something or other. And but he, as an adjunct to this, he wove in a little bit of this his thoughts about – he said he was very glad to be a gay man. And he said, I'm glad that I'm gay. And he said that I feel sorry for straight men because straight women don't appear to like sex very much. And he said relative to male sex drive, he said straight women don't really seem to be into sex that much as compared to their male counterparts. And so I'm very lucky. I'm glad I'm a gay man. And women just like came unglued at him and said that he was a misogynist and whatever. But his point, his response was very simple. And I thought fairly impeccable in terms of its logic. Where he just said, look, there's, you know, hookers on every corner for men. There aren't hookers on every corner for women. Case closed. And a woman responded by saying, well, that's just because women are choosier than men. And he said, again, case closed. And said, well, there are no hookers for women because we could get sex whenever we want. And he said, yes, why do you think it is that you can get sex whenever you want, ladies? Case closed. There is no response to that that does not strengthen the argument that men like sex more than women. I mean, rogue exceptions aside, there's just no evidence that doesn't support that. I mean, there are women who are, you know, who are wired up, I think, differently than most, and there are men who are wired up more differently than most. But I mean, I think that is the best example you could possibly give. That's why there's brothels for men and not really for women all that much, because women don't need them. Because every guy you pass on the street would F you probably if you asked him to. So, you know, and it just doesn't work the other way. And I mean, that is. If that's not evidence, I don't know what – then we've changed the definition of evidence.
I'm not sure that it's evidence of more of an interest in sex, though, as it is evidence that men tend to be more excited by sex with someone new than
women.
Well,
those are two separate things. I think that just because one is true doesn't mean the other – I mean, those are, you know, separate issues. I mean, I don't think one – and whatever the reason, I mean, it's like – Whatever the thing that is causing it, whatever the underpinning or justification, you're just talking about motivation now as opposed to actual behavior. I mean, as to why that might be, I mean, there are any number of reasons why it might be. You're just talking about what makes it that way. I mean, I think that it is that way, though, generally speaking.
Maybe I just know unusual women, too, because it seems like the women I know have had many, many more partners over the course of their life than the men that I know have. And also that I know a great many women who will say that once in a relationship, they find
that they
are more interested in sex than their partners.
Do you know why those women have had many more partners? Because they couldn't find a guy who wouldn't F them. Guys have great difficulty finding a broad range of women who will just F them at the drop of a hat. I mean, again, this all – everything you're saying just underscores my point. If you take 10 women and 10 men and put them in a room, I mean, and you just – the women go down the line and they ask each guy, hey, you want to go in the back, a little in out? The majority of those guys – I mean, again, and it's, you know, all things being equal, go like, yes, I would. Let's go have sex by the dumpster right now. But if you just put 10 women and 10 men in a row, and the men go down the line to each woman and go, hey, you, me in the back, a little ha-ha, the women are probably going to go, ooh, that sounds kind of disgusting. No, thanks. So that's why the women you know have more partners, because they talk to guys, and guys were like, sure, let's go for it. You take a guy and send him out there in the world and just have him, you know, try to replicate that experience, it's not really going to happen. I mean, that is just the way of – and by the way, I have no degree in, like, evolutionary biology, but I think that an evolutionary biologist would tell you that it is designed by nature to be so.
Because
you only got
that.
The one egg a month, you know, so you got to be careful. You got to be choosy. Nature has programmed women to be choosy and selective, you know, and nature has programmed, I think, men to not be that way because, again, they got the, you know, be, you know, leave sperm on every bus stop, Don. I mean, really, if you wanted to. Not you as such.
And
not
thank you.
Not at bus stops, probably.
No, maybe not.
Yeah. I'm just saying. So, but this is – a lot of this, though, is like Stephen Fry was talking about this. And he – I felt really bad for him because he said it like as a passing observation in this article about how he embraced his own nature as a gay man. And he said he – it was – I think it was part of that whole the It Gets Better thing that there was that campaign about telling young gay people like it gets better. And his whole thing was like being gay is awesome. And, you know, and it's great and it's wonderful. And he said, as a matter of fact, I feel sorry for straight men because, you know, straight blokes seem to have a lot of difficulty, you know, getting off with the ladies because, you know, they don't always seem interested. Gay men, on the other hand. And it was just like this sort of passing thing he said as sort of a comedic aside. And there's a lot of lambasting going on. And, you know, and then I felt bad for him because it's like he was trying to respond. And he's obviously a smart, funny guy, but he stepped into a.
Yeah.
Stepped into a sticky wicket, Don.
Mm. As the British people say.
Jolly good.
Territory.
All right.
The sticky territory.
What are we even doing here?
I don't know. We're going to talk about Justified.
All right. Let's see. All right. Where's my Justified bed? Wait, do we have anything? Okay, we'll do a Penis Watch tomorrow.
Yeah.
Yes, okay. So we'll do a Penis Watch tomorrow. Also, Mr. Big Jim Willig be in the studio tomorrow. Another installment of Humor Me Comedy 101. Tomorrow, talking about the Marx Brothers. And if you are tuning in after tuning in and then leaving, guy didn't jump. But you kind of knew.
No, and the bridge is open now, looks like.
You knew he wasn't going to jump, so. All right. All right. Last night, Justified, Season 2, Episode 13, the Season 2 finale. Of Justified, your thoughts, Don Taylor?
Well, first of all, I want to play.
You have a little audio
there? I want to play this little bit here, which just delighted me.
Awesome.
To death, because I love the character of Art.
Yes.
Yes. So here we go.
Is the I'm sorry. Do I need to turn that up over here? Is your computer? Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't have you potted up. That's
okay,
my phone.
There you go.
Okay. There we go.
All right. All right. If I got this right. Whoa.
Jesus.
No!
Drop your weapons or you will be shot. Assume the position. Now! Do you dumbass Packerwoods understand English? On the ground, hillbillies. Now!
How great is that?
Yes.
That's awesome. I mean, because here's the thing here's what makes that so great is... What makes that so great is there was that whole sequence you actually zeroed in on a few weeks ago, where Boyd and Raylan were talking, and Boyd said, well, you know, we are kind of on the same side now, and Raylan said, you know, like, you know, the only thing we're on the same side of is like this car door or whatever. The only thing we've got in common is like this car or something like that. But it is. It's every now and again they'll do something that is sort of that steps back from what the show occasionally threatens to become, which is this sort of like hillbillies on parade. There is that whole sequence when right before the whole attack on Ava Crowder happened. And it's like you just hear literally like this banjo twanging and then just some idiots coming across the plane with muskets, you know, basically. And you think to yourself, like, God damn, is the South really like this down there? No wonder I've never set foot in the South. You're just gonna be gunned down by some toothless wonder that, you know, the second you land at the airport. But then they do something like that, which pulls back, and you know, and you realize that to a large degree, what Justified is about. Justified, I make a lot of parallels with them. I mean, make a lot of comparisons to The Wire, and while the shows are very different, and The Wire is a much more layered and texturally complex show, there are some parallels in the sense that with both of them, it's not like you're just seeing hillbillies as such any more than. I don't think that it's you're seeing cliches any more than The Wire is representative of inner city cliches. What you're basically seeing is certain kinds of human behavior at a certain level, whether it has to do with crime or whether it has to do with education, whether it has to do with poverty, and the way that all of those behaviors manifest themselves when filtered through the region and the cultural traditions of that place. And so that's why you see stuff like this, which on the one hand seems so unbelievable that there are just these hee-haw numbskulls, you know, riding around with guns and talking about like moonshine or whatever. But I mean, you got to realize that I think growing up in any part of the country, you know, if you're in some just dirt poor district, I think you are lagging like four decades behind the rest of the country in a lot of ways, and that manifests itself in things like this, which is what makes that juxtaposition so great, is when they suddenly step back and they put it in the context of the broader 2011 world, where you realize, like, hey, this isn't the cast of Deliverance, a-hole, get on the ground.
Yes.
And I love that character so much. Mm. And his interactions with Raylan are so great and so awkward lately, because there's that whole thing of, like, well, Raylan is just so untrustable in his eyes.
And it's like it's almost like he's kind of a disappointed father in a way, because, you know, he kind of got stuck with Raylan and didn't really want him in the first place, but then grew to like him, grew to trust him, and was figuring out how to work with him, and thought that they had trust between them. Then he catches Raylan, you know, up to no good.
Aiding and abetting his ex-wife stealing money.
Oh, God, I'm hoping she does leave. Yeah. Man, her threatening to leave. I'm going without you. It's like, good.
She really is. And it's not even really her. It is the actress, I think.
Yeah, there's just no chemistry between the two of them.
She's like Mandy in the first season of The West Wing. They just got to get rid of her.
And it's kind of strange. She was on the show Dirty Sexy Money. And she had a lot of she was this horribly spoiled rich girl who had once had a childhood fling with Peter Krause's character, and now even though he was like married and has a kid and that sort of thing, she just had set her cap for him, and she was gonna have him, and she was just like filthy rich and spoiled rotten, and she was hilarious. She really has a great gift for comedy, and it's very weird to see her in this role. And she had a really really terrific chemistry with Peter Krause.
Right.
So it's not really that she's not good.
It just doesn't go in this show.
She's ill cast, and she really doesn't have any chemistry with Oliphant.
And she feels like she's been dropped in from central casting. There's only a couple characters on Justified who just they all seem like their characters. She seems like an actress. She just and that's not because she's like pretty or whatever. She just seems a little too. She just doesn't. I don't feel like she's really in. I sound like such a pretentious dick, but I was going to say that you look, Timothy Oliphant just sort of vanishes because he sort of is Raylan Givens. He just kind of internalizes that. And she just doesn't have that. The other example of that is I forgot the young girl, because she has like an old woman's name, and I always want to call her like
Loretta.
Gladys, Loretta.
Yeah.
You know, Loretta, but again, she's a young actress, so it's like, you know, what are you going to do? But, she's the only other point in that show where I feel like sometimes it just, you step back and it's just this side of believable. But,
I am sad to see the Megs saga come to an end.
How great is she, though?
God, she's good. She has got to get an Emmy nomination for her work this season in the show, because she was just magnificent.
I didn't really expect that ending when she poured, you know, the apple cider, the apple wine, or whatever it is, and then when she said, she said the thing about, you know, it was already in the glass. I did kind of suss out, okay, it's herself.
Yeah.
Like I never seriously thought she was going to poison Raylan, but I have to say that I didn't see that particular ending coming. And the way that they mirrored it by having her give a variation on that same speech that she gave to Loretta's dad was really sort of great and kind of sweet in a way. So
yeah.
I am sad to see her go, but it was sort of kind of the way that it had to end. I don't think that it could have gone any other direction. I mean, I actually made a note to myself last night. Let's see, Justified. I said, I made three notes about last night. One, Loretta, I said, the girl is kind of a weak link. She works better on the page than on the screen. If you read, that's the problem with that weird Elmore Leonard style dialogue sometimes too. If you read it, it's sort of, you go like, oh, it's great. And it's sort of this weird quasi-Victorian, you know, yet rural language. But sometimes the stuff that reads well on the page looks weird or sounds weird on the screen. The other thing is I wrote, what is Mags Bennett's, like, backstory? Like, I want to know what, like, what is her deal? Like, where does she come from? I mean, I know she's from there, but like, what is her life? Like, what brought her? What are the last 50 years of her life like? I would almost watch a series that was just her tracking her from, you know, 25 or from 15 to that point in her life. I'd love to see the Mags Bennett story.
It's interesting where they've left us, too, for the end of the series, because now it really did wrap everything up really nicely. And the only things that we now have set up are basically Harlan County is wide open for Boyd now. And Dickie's still alive.
Right.
Everybody, right. All the Bennetts are going except for Dickie. So, and Dickie, but Dickie just does not have the brains to handle all the family business by himself.
Does not.
It just can't. And everyone else is dead. So it's not like, you know, so where is he going to go now? What's going to happen? I mean, it's probably going to go to jail, but I mean, what's going to happen with him after?
I don't know. And so now maybe,
And I guess Arlo is in bed with Boyd.
I was gonna say there's Arlo, and maybe they form some weird trifecta of evil, the three of them or somehow. But it's just like that's such a weird, you know. I just know that Arlo is gonna. My whole thing is that he will make the play to be the guy that runs the entire thing, and they will set up some weird, you know, they'll have some weird thing of Raylan versus his dad. They'll have some Luke Darth thing where Arlo makes the play to become the big bad of the town.
I guess, but I also can't help but think that if he and Boyd work together for any length of time, he's gonna try and screw Boyd, and that's going to go very, very badly for him.
It is. The other thing I wrote, the other question is. Is it like another little thing that I think this word predates The Wire, but I never heard it used this way until The Wire, and they used it several times. Last night on the Justified, they talked about the situation setting up a parlay.
Yeah,
which is a thing they do on The Wire, and I guess that is a real term. It's from like it apparently is a British term from mm-hmm. hundreds of years ago, but I had never ever heard it until The Wire. And The Wire occasionally that would happen, like once or twice during the course of the series, some character would set up a parlay for another, which is like where he would guarantee the safety of the two representatives, one from the Montagues and one from the Capulets, and they'd have to leave their guns outside.
I'd never heard of it until Pirates of the Caribbean, and I was really surprised to hear it come up on The Wire.
Yeah,
so
and it's I think that was a nice little tip of the hat to something there.
Yeah.
But you're right. I just don't know. And you know, another little great cyclical thing was that they ended the show with that same kind of bluegrass song that they started the season with, which is did they open the season with it or did they end last season? I think they ended season one with it. It's called Life in Harlan County. Whatever. And there's also that weird moment where Raylan actually is talking to Art and he wants to leave. You know, and it's an Art, I don't think everything actually answers him. I think he says, I'll think about it.
Well, but I like that. So you want me to give you a promotion?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, yeah.
But in a weird way, it's
and then
sort of
kind of looking at without, because they're not going to talk about what's going on.
Right.
But Art's disbelief that, okay, you know, you pulled this crap and we're not talking about it. And I've told you about my deep, deep disappointment in your abilities as a marshal. Oh, and you want me to give you a promotion just so you can like move away with the girlfriend?
It is that thing of like because of his own poor choices. Now Raylan is the guy because of course it's the whole thing of like it is the old story you see a million times where the guy who has escaped his childhood home has to go back there and has to, like, you know, right the wrong in the place he swore he'd never return to. Just like, you know, it's like the gunfighter who swore he'd never draw a gun again and has to, like, has to take off his collar and put on his guns or whatever. And now they've gotten to the second sort of act of that, which is where he once again, like, tries to leave, even though, again, it's by... And if he hadn't done all of this crap, if Raylan had just said, look, you know, if he hadn't done any of the crap and earned Art's distrust, he would be able to say, like, I want to do this and get out of this town and be gone. And Art would probably have done it.
Yeah.
But now because of his own poor choices, he has like put this circle of hell around his own head. Now he is trying to leave. And because of his choices, he is now trapped in this horrible purgatory of his town. And he has done it to himself again. You know, his choices put him back in the town. And then his choices now, because he could have gotten out, his choices now are keeping him. In the town. So it really, it's, I love little layering like that. But now it's going to be like a long year and a half or whatever until it comes back.
God, I know.
So, all right. Which means I guess we got one more slot in our TV viewing. So if anybody knows a thing that's on, like, you know, Wednesdays or, you know, wherever. All right.
So for those of you who are going to be driving home soon and doing whatever else you say, don't take the Ross Island Bridge. Because it apparently was a crime scene. And so now it's probably going to be, like, closed down until, like, 7 o'clock tonight while guys walk, like three or four cops just walk around on it. And no one is allowed to go anywhere.
Which means that everybody then has to go down to, like, the Selwood Bridge. So, which you know, is crumbling apart. So have fun with that. All right, there's your Justified recap. Join us tomorrow when our guests will include Mr. Big Jim Willig with Humor Me Comedy 101. Tomorrow, talking about the life, legacy, and career of the Marx Brothers. Don't forget, I'll be guesting on Geek in the City Radio. That'll be tonight, but I guess it's posted tomorrow around 10 a.m. on Friday. Geek in the City Radio. You can hear it directly at geekinthecity.com or subscribe at iTunes, Geek in the City. And I forgot that. How was yesterday's ham-fisted radio, Don Taylor?
Oh, it was delightful. It was fine. We just talked about stuff.
Okay.
Talked about you a little bit.
That sounds like something you'd like to hear.
I talked about our discussion about the t-shirts.
Our tiff. All right.
So if you want to hear that, that is posted at hamfistedradio.com.
Yeah, you can hear that Wednesdays, 4 p.m. Pacific time, cascadia.fm or at hamfistedradio.com. With that, we bring the curtain down on this, another exciting episode of the Rick Emerson Radio Program, made possible by a generous grant from y'all, so thank you for that. Continue to spread the word, if you will. Don't forget, we're now 1 week away from the signing for Zombie Economics. It happens 1 week from today, next Thursday, May 12th. At Barnes & Noble Lloyd Center, 7 p.m. You can find out more by going to zombieeconomics.com. That is zombieeconomics.com. That is 1 week from tonight, Barnes & Noble Lloyd Center, 7 p.m. At the news desk, Don Taylor, advanced technology and magic provided by Mr. Thomas Gill, executive producer, who wears Axe Phoenix, by the way, a particular scent within the Axe line. Mm. Executive producer Bruce Agler, chief of staff Cheryl Kanakoa. As always, we thank you for listening, and et cetera, and et cetera, and et cetera. Legion of News, followed by an encore of this radio program betwixt the two, a musical interlude. It is Thursday, May 5th, 2011, and that is the frequency, Kenneth. As always, thank you for listening. Be safe. See you all tomorrow. Bye now.